Hello and welcome to episode 100 of the Crate and Crowbar Woo, indeed, Tom.
The Crate and Crowbar Woo.
We started early. Today is the 7th of July, 2015. My name is Chris Thurston. Today I'm joined by Tom Woo Francis.
That is my middle name. Hello.
Tom Senior.
Tom Who Senior, I think you're fine.
Graham Smith.
Graham Yippee Smith.
And Marsh Davies.
Well, hey.
Oh, I thought it would be simply sigh. Oh. We're all here to celebrate the centenary of this podcast.
Happy birthday, us.
Happy birthday. That's not how birthdays or years work.
It does feel like we've been doing this for 100 years,
though. It does, yeah. Many.
More than 200 hours. A lot more than 200 hours of chat.
Yeah, a lot more than that. Yeah. It's terrifying.
Yeah, it's a little bit alarming.
It's a tedious thought.
Not even about PC games, just drunken, slurring nonsense.
Yeah. Indeed.
We actually, I think listen to a lot of other podcasts. I think we're probably more on topic than most. I think whenever I listen to the Giant Bombcast, which is massively popular, I've never really got into it. Every time I listen to it, it's just like, now they're talking about wrestling for like half an hour. They just go off into whether their friend should borrow some money for some reason.
I used to love Bombcast actually when I was working, not in this industry, because it filled an entire afternoon. And there's just something very pleasant about listening to people speak about things they're passionate about.
I need to get over the hump where I kind of know them well enough that I kind of just enjoy it anyway.
Wow, this is a weird meta off topic that we're doing.
Yeah. We never go off topic.
We've come off topic. We're talking about how goddamn on topic we are. Yeah.
Since it's the 100th episode, here's some other video game podcasts you might like to listen to instead.
Like Board of the Quake and Crowbar.
It seems like 2 years ago that we first gathered in a graveyard to do this, and for some reason we haven't stopped.
Perform the ritual.
And not only have we haven't stopped, but our plans are escalating or changing in some way that Tom will now explain.
Yeah. We, doing this is really fun, but, there's a kind of limit on how much time, us in general can devote to extra activities and, how much time we can put into it outside of the time it takes to record it. And we also have varying hosting costs. And what we'd like to do is have like a fund, like a company bank account for the Crate and Crowbar that we then use as a fund to pay for hosting, and possibly for those of us who are freelance to pay themselves for their time when they do extra projects for Crate and Crowbar, like the Dark Souls video series and things like that, so that we can do more of that stuff, and then other things maybe, depending on how well it goes. So we'd like to have a Patreon for that.
Hooray!
And we're going to set that up at some indeterminate point soon.
Within the next fortnight, I believe, is the resolution.
You're locking us in.
I'm locking us in. We're going to do it. We've been talking about it for a long time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And people keep asking us, hey, can we give you money in some way? And we're like
no, we don't like that kind of thing.
Never. We'll never allow you to do that.
I think we've literally sent money back to people.
Oh, actually, I tell you what, we did get... I forgot to mention it because I wasn't on the podcast immediately afterwards, but somebody did actually send us £20 to spend on booze.
Oh, nice.
Which I didn't, I just kept mine.
I just kept mine.
But I will one day spend the money, and I will remember that guy's name at some point in the future and give him a shout out.
Especially by spending the money and thanking the guy, but not actually spending it on booze.
Or thanking the guy, except for his name. So
Marsh is running his own private Patreon. We're going to change that relationship.
This is like embezzlement, really.
This is why you can absolutely trust us with our crowdfunding initiative.
We kind of, a lot of it is we just want to see whether it's viable or just what it would be, like whether it would be $5 a month from two strangers or whether it would be more than that and something we could do something with. Mm.
A modest start, but we want it to be kind of to scale with how much interest there is, really, because we have no idea. No idea whatsoever. So we'll find out. If you want more details about that, I imagine we'll post on the internet website, which is crankcrowbar.com, and honk about it on Twitter. At Crate and Crowbar. That'll happen.
Honk.
Yep. Honk. To the business at hand, though, Tom. Computer games,
Yeah, they're good. In general. Actually, maybe they're not.
I go through this.
Maybe now's the time to say.
I don't know.
Nice. Second time.
What am I doing?
I did have an evening recently where I fired up like 4 different games and just hated them all. Just like, I fired up Batman again and... I don't think it ran any worse than it did before, but I just got to the point where I wasn't actively engaged in doing a new part of the main quest. I was stuck on one thing and irritated with another thing. And as soon as I wasn't making forward progress, I started to notice that actually this isn't running that well, doesn't look that great. It's just the fact that it's not immediately pleasurable to play means that I don't really want that. And then I fired up The Witcher 3, and again, I keep kind of bouncing off it. I like lots of things about it, but I just really don't like Geralt. I just don't want to be him. I don't want to be in this world, particularly. The writing of the quests is good so far, but I'm just kind of repelled by the person I'm playing. And then something else, I can't remember what third game I didn't like it. I just started to think, like, maybe I just hate games. Maybe I'm just not, like, the enthusiastic gamer I used to be. But I think it's much more like I've just got to much more prioritize stuff that's just immediately fun to play, like tactile and fun to play. And stuff like Spelunky and things I can keep going back to again and again once I know I like them.
Mentioning Spelunky on the 100th podcast.
I almost did a daily. That was, my desperation was such that I almost thought about just going back and doing Spelunky daily, because I think Chris Donlan still does them. Chris Remo did them every day for a year, like without a single break, and then he missed one when he went to like on a camping trip. And then because he missed one, it just completely robbed him of his desire to play at all.
The curse was broken, he used it.
Yeah, it's free. Yeah, he doesn't miss it at all. Nothing I do, really. Anyway, I played Axiom Verge.
Hey!
That wasn't really like an intro to that. But just...
Speaking of terrible games you hate,
Well, no, surprisingly.
I don't really know anything about it. What is it?
It's a side-on... retro, visually retro, Metroid-like, and it's very much a Metroid-like. The thing it's been praised for all over the place is it's like a true successor to Metroid.
Huh.
Or maybe Super Metroid, I don't know actually either of those games. And all I know of those games is that things get called Metroidvanias, and that means that you'll come to some blue barriers, and you can't open any of the blue barriers until you get the blue upgrade, and you'll come to some high perches, and you can't get to the high perches until you get double jump. And I haven't often liked them. Like, I don't love... It really annoyed me in Batman Arkham Asylum, actually.
Oh, yeah.
when you'd come up against, like, a Riddler trophy and you just didn't know whether you could get it or not, because you'd understand the elements that are involved in the puzzle to get there. But later on, one piece of your equipment might be upgraded to interact with those in a different way that you don't know is possible yet. So you just don't know, is this a puzzle for me to solve or do I just need to move on? And I talked a bit about it before, with Ori and the Blind Forest. I kind of had that problem a little bit where there is,
yeah,
I'll change the colors to avoid, telling anyone anything they might not want to know, but like there's, let's say, pink barriers, and every time you come to a pink barrier, you're supposed to understand that, oh, you just have to wait until you get the pink power and then you can solve that. And then you come to some green barriers. And so I think, okay, I have to wait until I get the green power, and then you just get stuck on like, I'm stuck here. Okay. Backtrack, find a new route to go. Okay. I'm stuck there as well. And find a new route to go. And then eventually it turns out there is a way to take out the green barriers with my current skill set that involves nothing that's green.
Oh.
Just a way of tricking things into interacting in a particular way. It's not green, but that kind of thing annoyed me. But Axiom Verge is really good at it. And like I said, I've never played Metroid, so I can't talk about how it measures up to that. But it's the art style is definitely retro. It's not just pixel art, it's actually retro. And really nice in its way. And very, feels very hand drawn and very kind of, I don't know, lovingly crafted, I guess. And movement feels really good. It kind of, I don't know quite how to describe it, but a lot of retro style games I play sort of also mimic the slight clunkiness that old games had in terms of just not feeling smooth and, often they force like a 4:3 aspect ratio, or they only run in a window or something. Mm. And I'm playing this on like a 40-inch monitor, and it's just kind of really cool to see a retro game like that completely fill the screen and feel perfectly smooth. And although most of it's authentic, they haven't tried to do, I think, I haven't played it, but I think Shovel Knight like sort of enforces a lot of the limitations of NES games on itself. And I know Super Win the Game also is meant to be very authentic to NES era games. And this, I don't know how authentic it is in general, but it does things like particle effects that wouldn't have been possible back then. And I keep noticing just the odd thing that's way better than games were back then. And yeah, the Metroidvania stuff, that sounds like a weird thing to say, but the barriers that you don't know whether you can open them or not. So far, I haven't had any trouble. It's always been really clear. And I'm starting to see what people like about them, or what people like about Metroid, because it's always talked about in very reverent tones. And I've never really understood what people are
appreciating about those games, because every time I play a game that's based on it, like I say, I usually have some kind of trouble because of the Metroidvania structure. But it has this feel of, when it's working, which it, so far it is in Axiom Verge, you always know whether you can or can't progress in a certain screen. But sometimes you can't, because you can see, oh, like there's a room where just like some fragile blocks in part of the floor in a column going straight down. And I'm like, well, obviously at some point I'll be able to destroy those, but I can't right now. So just immediately clear, nothing else in the room, just leave again. But also sometimes you just kind of, you explore a path and you get to the end of that bit. And there might not necessarily be a big glowing power-up at the end of it, and you're just going to get there, and then you just go back. Or there's like a save point, and that's useful, and then you go back. And it starts to feel much more... It doesn't feel like levels. I think partly maybe because it's retro as well. Like the sort of... Because it's a series of rooms and corridors. I was trying to think, why didn't I get this feeling with Ori and the Blind Forest? Because that is similar in terms of it's very non-linear, and you go back and forth. And in that, I got a little bit annoyed at having to backtrack. And I think it's because in that game, it was meant to look like a natural environment, and it was absolutely beautiful. But that meant the leveliness of it showed through. You always knew, oh, the reason for this bit to be here is to get to that power-up, and then you just go back along this path. And so because I know that's a gamey structure, I'm kind of a little bit tired of going back along that path. Whereas this, it really feels like a strange alien world where there's not necessarily any reason for that corridor to lead over there, and I'm just going down there just to see what's down there, and there will be some weird piece of art, and then I just go back. And some of those might be, you know, other routes forward that I just haven't found yet. But so far, I'm really liking the sense of exploration. And I check the map like maybe every 15 minutes. And it's not because I'm sitting there thinking, ah, God, where do I go? Or God, I don't want to backtrack again. Or it's not because I'm frustrated or lost. It's because I've got like 5 different exits I could take. And I just want to check, have I taken those bottom 2 before? And oh, yeah, I have. So I should take one of the top 3. So it's just got a really nice feeling of, I've always got new places to go, and it's always kind of interesting. It's got really interesting... you played a bit, Tom, right?
Yeah, I played loads of it, and I really like it. But I just enjoying you explain why you like it.
So I've just got the glitch gun. It's really cool. But this is one of the things that interested me about it. Actually, I wasn't really compelled to play it by people giving it incredibly high review scores or saying it's the true successor to Metroid, because I hadn't played Metroid, and I didn't think I'd like that kind of game. But... another podcast you should listen to, Video Games Hot Dog. we're talking about it and started talking about this glitch gun that sounded really intriguing to me, where it's like you fire out a sort of cone of like squares, and stuff trapped within it, like enemies and certain bits of the scenery, just change in response to it. And you can turn enemies into just glitched versions of themselves. So one is, the least exciting one I found so far is like, there's this big scampery scorpion thing and it fires like this spectacular array of bullets, or just a very copious amount of bullets in rapid succession and a spread. And when you glitch him, he kind of goes a bit wobbly, and then he just fires like one tiny little stream of bullets, like really slowly, really pathetic, and you go pew, pew, pew. And a recurring problem I have with a glitch gun is because I don't know what it does. I like that you have to experiment and find out. It does something different to each different enemy. But I also need to test what it did by throwing myself into the bullets. That's firing at bullets. Do those heal me? No, they're just bullets. It's firing less bullets, but they're still bullets. And then on other enemies, there's like some that are sort of, I think they might be toxic bubbles or things that are emitted from like an urchin on the floor and drifting up. And if you glitch them, they just turn into platforms that you can stand on, and that becomes a way to solve puzzles. And the best one I found is this hideous like pustule hives that previously were spitting out flying enemies, like generating them. And if you glitch them, then I'm not sure if you have to kill the flying enemies first, but at some point it just starts belching out health. So I think it's just an infinite supply of health. I mean, you just use it as like a healing point that you can heal up from. And until then, health had been really, really rare and a really like scarce resource. So that's awesome. And then there's like these little kind of sucker enemies that kind of shuffle along the floor, and then if they reach like an edge, they'll go down the edge and then they'll go underneath the ceiling and stuff. And an upgraded later version of those you fight have, if they see you, if you jump over them or something, they fire a laser, and the laser kind of stays on for a while. And I found if you hack them, the laser no longer hurts you, which is cool. And then I also found that if you tempt them into shooting certain areas of the level, the new laser destroys that part of the level. And then there are other ones where like, they're just like bouncy ball things, and if you glitch them, the sprites glitch as well. Like, it's not done like, It looks like the game is breaking. It's not, I'm not sure what word, it's not diegetic? It's not representative of something that I think is happening in the game world. At least it doesn't seem so. It seems like it's sort of breaking the game. And so the sprite for this circular enemy gets glitched so that the two hemispheres are kind of, it's like split down the middle and then both sides are mirrored. So it looks almost like a butterfly. And then it flies around and every bit of the wall it hits just smashes through. And so there are bits that, I guess they must be scripted because you'll see one trapped in the wall and you can, your glitch gun goes through walls so you can just glitch it from out there and then it will turn into this chaotic butterfly and smash up a bunch of the inside of the level and then create like a path for you to go in and get some power up or progress that way.
Can you just completely circumvent the blue door stuff by
I don't know. I can't tell you how scripted it is. I suspect those bits, because it's an enemy that's trapped in the wall, you couldn't ever do anything with it except glitch it. And when you do glitch it, it happened to make a path from me to a power-up or from me to an area where I could get to something useful. I assume that was all scripted and it couldn't have gone anywhere else. But it's up to you when you kill them. Like, you glitch it, it breaks a bit of the wall, and I just kind of shot it after that because I thought, I don't want it to hit me. And then the next one I did, I left it alive and it broke a bunch more of the level. So I don't know how far that goes. Maybe you know, Tom.
They're pretty scripted in that it'll never let you break past a new item you need to get, one of those doors or barriers. But there are loads of amazing secrets in it. And it really reminds me of playing Super Mario for the first time. There's a brilliant bit in Super Mario where you can kind of get on top of the level where there are these, you know, there's the roof and you can find a way to jump onto the roof. It feels like you've broken it. And by design, it gives you that sense of, sense of power. It's like, I've defeated the game designers. I can skip this whole bit of level. And there's loads of stuff like that in Axiom Verge as well, where there are loads of weapons and most of them you could just go through the entire game without discovering them. And I think a lot of the kind of lazy way that a lot of this sort of game does its gating systems is by giving you different weapons. Whereas in Axiom Verge, that's not the case at all. Its weapons are entirely the ones you want to use, and there's a great variety of them. They fire in different patterns, and they behave differently. But the actual mechanisms for getting past the different gated scenarios are really inventive, so you can phase through walls. You get a trench coat that lets you phase through walls by one block, and it feels like incredibly powerful, and you suddenly realise that, oh my god, all those places where there was just like little rooms with power-ups that I can never get to, I can suddenly go back.
And I'm already thinking of those as you're saying this.
Yeah, exactly. It's terrific at giving you that sense of just sudden empowerment. And it's never frustrating when you see something that you can't get to, but then it's very empowering when you find a way to actually get to those things that you saw. So for example, you pick up, there's one kind of interim room out of just hundreds of rooms where you just drop through it and never think of it. But if you stay in there for a little bit and look, you can see a very subtle kind of pixelated animation in a very narrow strip of blocks. And if you use the glitch gun on that, it obliterates the blocks. And if you have a power-up you get is like a little drone that you can control and deploy outside of yourself and have running around away from you. And you jump that guy up into it. And then you head left. And if it's that Super Mario feeling of having broken the game. It's like, oh God, I've escaped. I've escaped. The game designers kind of contrived barriers for me. And it goes into Glitch World, which is an entire dimension of just fucked up geometry and stuff. And creatures that are kind of half broken, that are kind of lunging out at you and stuff. And you're just guiding your little, tiny, little, helpless drone. You can't even barely attack anything through this world. Just horrible, messed up things.
And, oh my God.
And it's full of amazing secrets like that. It's brilliant. There's loads of stuff I love about it. I love the art as well, which actually literally gave me nightmares.
Wow. It's a very strange mix, I think, in terms of the aesthetic, in that I love the art too. I love the feeling of it being an alien world and not really a world, an alien level or alien space with its own logic and weird creatures and things that can be glitched and stuff. But it's got an intro and the character you play is just like regular dude McRegular dude and it's so doesn't need that. I wish I was just some weird, I don't know, humanoid thing or just someone in a suit of armor like in Metroid where you don't really know who you are on the inside, and I wish everything was just completely mysterious because all my characters said, I kind of skipped bits of the intro, I got the gist of it. There was some science experiment, I don't know, things blew up, but all my characters said to everything, including like every boss fight, he'll try and talk to the boss first. And you could talk to the bosses, and you can't. So all he ever says to them is, I don't know what I'm doing here. I don't know how I got here. Who are you? Oh, wow. He just adds nothing to it. All he does is just like force a personality on you that you don't really want, which is an idiot who's like, whoa, what's going on here? It's like I'm in a video game. And it's not going to explain anything. It's not like he says, There were bits in Mass Effect where I got annoyed. The only time they didn't like Shepard were every now and then they needed Shepard just to ask questions because they wanted to give you some information. And the only way for that person to give you that information is Shepard asked them. So like Mass Effect 2, when you walk around a ship, if you use the AI terminal thing, Shepard's question would always be, what's this area of the ship? Yeah, this is your fucking the crew quarters. You live here. What the fuck?
Yeah.
But that's somewhat forgivable when they have some information they need you to be able to get access to. But here you don't get any information. You just go around asking everyone, what's going on? I don't know what I'm doing here. And that's fine. I don't mind not knowing what I'm doing here. But then don't have an intro about it. And just make it mysterious. Make it a weird world I'm exploring and just like, I don't know who the fuck right. I am and I don't know what I'm doing. But I'm not saying that to everyone.
It's kind of jarring that, yeah, this really weird world with kind of Geiger influences and... it's the site of some sort of horrible disease, so you go into wandering mode, it's just mountains of bodies climbing over, and it's like, oh, this has suddenly got dark. But you're fundamentally just a man in a red t-shirt. And that kind of jarring, just the, maybe they intended it to be this ordinary bloke, but it just looks so strange. Everything else is so beautifully designed and looks so strange. And I bought this out at Primark.
I guess it's probably intentional. They're probably,
if
they're listening to this, they're probably not thinking, oh my God, they're so right. We made an ordinary guy in the alien world. If only that could occur to us. I think it must be just an attempt to either ground you or maybe emphasize how alien everything else is by making you sort of ordinary.
I guess there's games that have used that to interesting effect before, like Another World.
I was going to mention Another World, actually.
You know, where you are a man in a t-shirt. In the preface to this conversation, before you started talking about Axiom Verge, you referenced a game in which there was a green door and you thought you needed like a green key or something like that, but it turned out there was some other way to get through it with just knowledge that you didn't have yet. What game is that?
Ori and the Blind Forest.
Okay. That sounds like a good thing to me.
It's just that there were both types. There were the types because this is a big glowing blue door, you should ignore it because you don't have the blue ability. And when there's a big glowing pink door, you shouldn't ignore it. You should sit there and think, how can I break that pink door without any kind of new ability?
And keeping to the theme of recommending things that aren't this podcast, there's a good video series, I think, called Game Maker's Toolkit by Mark Brown.
Oh, yes.
And he does an episode where he talks about Tokitori.
Yeah,
which is a really
amazing,
cute looking side scrolling platformer, which I completely dismissed to the point of never even bothering to play it because it just looks like a super retro platformer. But the reason that he likes it is he talks about it in terms of it being a Metroidvania in which there are areas where you see them and you initially think that you can't get there, you can't get up that high or anything. But later, when you return to those areas, you realize that you could have got there all along. It's just that you didn't yet have the information as to how the ecosystem of creatures work and how the powers that you already had could be used in order to manipulate that ecosystem of creatures and your environment.
I discovered that video because I bitched about Ori and the Blind Forest's Metroidvania thing on Twitter, and someone replied to me saying, hey, you should check out this Tokitori video.
Tokitori's really good. I played the first one, I think, all the way through. But the name does sound like a really heavy-handed parody of the current government's university years.
Yes.
That video demonstrated beautifully by showing that you can just, from the very start of the game, get to a place that's actually much later in the game if you just start knowing how everything works.
Yeah.
So he just flies up and just manipulates those creatures to propel himself to a part of the level just straight away, which is actually neat.
Yeah, it's super clever.
I love Metroid. I think I'm probably in the opposite camp where I should probably play Axiom Verge, but like I think Super Metroid for the SNES was one of the first games that ever really got me for atmosphere rather than just like, I'd like to be this hedgehog or...
the classic genre.
Yeah. Because you had that really powerful sense of place. And it's kind of interesting that, you know, Samus, back when Samus was anonymous, which is kind of an interesting thing, that character's become so unanonymous now that Zero Suit Samus is like the default version of that character, where it's just a blonde lady in a cat suit, whereas it used to be this sort of like completely anonymous. I think I'm probably of the last generation that will ever have played that game with that character and not known that it was a woman. But there was that really powerful sense of anonymity of being alone, despite being, you know, a space person in a suit with a gun for an arm. There was a real sense of that powerlessness and exploration. I think the thing, and I love Castlevania as well, but the thing that made those games succeed or fail for me, and I used to review tons of them because there was like a big resurgence in like Xbox Live Arcade and PSN, Metroidvanias like 4 or 5 years ago, is whether they give you, it's partly, as you say, there's the fairness of the challenge, like whether or not it's, you know, you're being rewarded for constantly pushing out and trying new options, but also whether or not you're being asked to remember too much. That's always the big criteria for me. It's like, there's a satisfaction to encountering like three things or four things that you can't do yet. And the moment where you go, ah, this new thing, that means I can go back to here. But there's a point at which it becomes totally overwhelming, where it's like, I've got to remember three potential double jump places, a blue door, a red door, a bombable wall, and that moment where you get one of those upgrades and you can no longer decide what the fuck you're going to do. Like, it's interesting, because there's so much about exploration, they still have to, like, negotiate this place between the moment you feel completely lost, I think, is the moment they lose you. Like, they succeed, I think, when they manage this kind of tension, where it's like, I'm constantly doing one thing, and I'm aware I could be doing two other things.
What was the game that Epic made? Which was,
Shadow Complex.
Yeah, I mean, that was really good. Yeah, it was really good, and it did solve that problem by just fucking labelling things on the map, basically. Like,
yeah.
Putting a red door on the map. You can't go there yet, but you can later.
In Axiom Verge, you can mark two places on the map as Reminder 1 and Reminder 2. Pressing the left and right sticks. I think so far it's been, I don't know, now I'm thinking some of those dead ends that earlier you said were probably pointless, probably aren't pointless, and there's probably some abilities that are outside the realm of what I'm imagining I'm capable of doing. But early on, the dead ends I was finding, it was very natural. I guess it's just quite, because it's a very small number of them, but it was easy, like, this one's one where I just can't jump that high, and this one's one where the switch to open this force field is behind the force field itself, so I need something else for that. And it's usually been clear what I need, and so that's kind of helped. I don't think I've actually memorized anything yet, in that when I get a new ability, I remember seeing some things that I could have done with that ability, but I don't actually have to, so far, figure out where those were and get back to them. I just look at the map and see, oh, I've got like four or five different exits that you can see on the map whether the top part of the room is a ceiling or whether it's a bit you haven't climbed up yet. Like, there's a no barrier there if it's just unexplored. So you can kind of see pretty quickly, okay, there's three different unexplored bits. And I just go back to one of those and figure it out from there. But yeah, I'm pretty early on, so.
Is the thing you mentioned earlier is the thing that makes or breaks these games, where it's, you get annoyed by having to backtrack through an area. But that, on the flip side, is often the kind of thing that appeals to me in those games. And it can go either way. Sometimes it does feel like a chore to go back through an area, but other times you get the sense of empowerment about kind of, returning to a space you've already kind of conquered once and being better at it the next time you go through it, having skills you didn't have before. And sometimes that feels extremely empowering, and sometimes it feels really boring and annoying. I'm not quite sure what the magic source is that makes a difference there.
I think the magic source is the combat system.
I think combat system or traversal, like basic traversal as well, it's like, I think helps.
It's like those games have a couple of different like vocabulary sets, and one of them is just like you're the keys you get that unlock areas in the environment, and sometimes the key is literally a key, and sometimes it's the missile launcher. The missile launcher opens missile doors.
Yes, of course.
Like someone in Mother Brain's hideout and just installed the rocket doors. Like you're fucked if you forget your keys. But like, but yeah, and then you have the kind of the softer mechanics, like the traversal and the combat, which are there to kind of provide challenges as you move through the levels. And if they are sufficiently skill-based and interesting.
Yeah, I think that's it. That is the key. Yeah.
Like, and the Metroid's genius is that it ties the two together. Like, you get the rockets and that changes the way you fight, but it also changes the way you open doors suddenly for some reason. And that's, like, Castlevania's exactly the same, that it has this, Rogue Legacy is, Apes, Castlevania's combat system almost exactly, and more than Castlevania does, builds a game around that, and that's because it's a really, really good combat system. So even if you're not good at unlocking things, you can still progress through the level, and every time you go back in a room, you fuck up them flying books much better than you did last time. Yeah. You're just fucking whipping flying books all day, because you've done it 15 million times.
I keep getting upgrades in Axiom Verge that just say, are bullets bigger? Which kind of amuses me. Why?
I wonder if procedural generation, like Splunky, is just a better way to deliver that same feeling now. That same feeling of going back through the same areas, like the mains at the start of Splunky, but not having the repetition of them literally being the same areas. But you are better at now at dealing with bats and skeletons than you were before.
I think it's a really interesting variant. I think part of the satisfaction of a traditional Metroidvania, is the tidying up satisfaction of finishing the level. Mm. Like, mapping it out. Yeah, and, like, knowing that there's a human designer behind it. So if something seems interesting in the environment, there's probably a reason. Like Tom was saying, with, you know, like, loads of Easter eggs and stuff stacked into it.
Spelunky has loads of Easter eggs as well, because there are scripted methods of going to secret worlds, like the...
For sure, but they're slightly different. There's not the same sort of sense that... There's also not the same sense that your progress is persistent as well, that you kind of like cracking the environment over time. Mm. I'd say they're like just two different sides of the same kind of experience.
Yeah.
But I don't think one's better than the other, I guess. It's like one doesn't replace the other. It's kind of predominant form.
Spelunky.
I mean, the reference to Batman is interesting, because I think, you know, Tom, you play a lot of it now as well. Like, I was going to say, because... The one thing I've obviously Arkham Knight is no longer for sale on PC and fucked on PC. But, I jumped ship and played on PS4. Tom, you did the same thing.
Yep.
Something I was going to say that's actually really interesting about it is it's sort of still got some Metroidvania stuff. It's also got shitloads of Easter eggs, and weirdly it combines the two. Like, there are tools you need to get Riddler trophies that are from previous games. And it doesn't give you them. And so figuring out how you get them is a puzzle in itself. And it's like, huh, and it's just completely a side thing. And when I finally figured it out, it felt really fucking obvious. And
so the puzzle is figuring out where to get that tool?
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. Because it's like, hang on, I recognise that bit of level geometry. That was a thing from Arkham City.
Yeah.
And you're like, but that tool isn't in this game. And its new version doesn't do the thing I needed to do. And yeah, figuring that out is really interesting. So, and that's kind of, I think, one of the most interesting things about that game, about Auroch City's games in general, in addition to all the other levels of like combat and traversal and stealth and bad tanks. they have this sort of absolutely like insane level of complexity just in kind of little environmental puzzles that are fucking everywhere. Mm. There's hundreds of the things.
I love Arkham Knights for... It kind of completes the series in a way that is more satisfying than most game series I've ever played, really, for actually setting up a proper arc for Batman from that first game right through to the end, to Arkham Knight. I've almost finished it. But kind of what it does with that character is really interesting in its own way. Mm. And I'm sure, like, I've not read a huge number of Batman comics, but it feels like a their own take on Batman and what could go wrong with Batman, or, you know, specifically, and which is really fucking interesting. And also, as Chris mentions, all the environmental callbacks to previous games makes just, they borrow a lot of the same visual language of the way puzzles work, and then just gradually expand them with each game. So now the Predator levels in Arkham Knight have all the gargoyles and, like, outcrops that you'd expect from previous games, but now they have poles, and they just keep adding to the language and keep adding to the ways that you can move around. And now you can just fuck off in this open world, just like leave and sweep around the entire environment, coming at it from a different direction if you want to. And it feels like a game of series that's just grown in really meaningful ways within the parameters that you expect. Like, it's not alien to you, but it's still this gradual kind of progression.
It's nice to see a series do that in comparison to the way that Assassin's Creed has kind of bloated.
Yeah, that's the perfect kind of counterpoint, like where... That's how Assassin's Creed never develops, it never improves in that way, whereas the Arkham series...
It's funny, I think the tank combat, you can see what they tried to do with it, and it's not fully fleshed out in the way that the other game systems are, and it's basically the only example of feature creep in a game that should be fucking covered in feature creep. This is the most open-worldiest installment in a previously initially not open-world, and then subsequently more and more open-world series. And, like, it reeks of feature creep, like having, you know, the missions where you kind of co-op with another AI superhero and lots of other stuff. And there's loads of ideas and loads of new ideas, but none of them feel like the tower defense bits in Assassin's Creed Revelations.
There's no, like, Bruce Wayne real estate mini game. Exactly. Buying up companies throughout Gotham.
There's making pointless bullshit, really. Like, and, you know, the tank stuff, it serves a purpose in the game. And I actually really like the Batmobile. Some people hate the Batmobile.
I love driving around. I love
car mode is great.
Chases, car mode is great. It's the only thing.
Other mode does a Batmobile
tank mode.
Oh, I see. Right,
strafing tank mode.
And the tank stuff, they've tried to build like a vehicle combat system that's quite interesting, and it kind of is like so when you're in tank mode, you've got 360 degrees, you can move forward, back, left, and right because it's strafe, and the bat computer shows you like enemy firing trajectories as lines in your vision. So it's about like positioning the Batmobile perfectly so that every shot goes around it. And if you think about it, like if you imagine that being in a film or a cartoon or a comic where you don't see what Batman's seeing, that would make it, that's a very Batman-y way to be a tank.
It sounds to me like that Japanese game show import where you stand on a conveyor belt and foam walls come towards you and you have to squeeze through the holes in the foam walls.
It is a bit like that, yeah. But you're also allowed to, on a fairly long cooldown cannon, fuck up pots of wall. Like,
if I wish his actual, like, in Predator sections, his way of dodging bullets and those was the same, and like you'd see the incoming lines, and he'd have to just contort his body into like the right shape so that all the lines miss.
Or like Craig Charles does voiceover on it.
But it does, you know, it kind of works, and it's just not sophisticated enough, and there's not enough, like, but playing it well doesn't reward you with feeling more like Batman in the way that all of the game's other systems work beautifully, whereas, like...
Yeah. If it was, like, three or four set pieces spread throughout the main quest, and that was it, I'd be totally fine with it. And it's, like, it's basically fine for playing it briefly. It's like, oh, this is relatively satisfying, and dodging those lasers is kind of cool. But it's just the prevalence of it. You just can't get away from it. And, like, the main plot will just shove you into a massive... I took a screenshot of, I just defeated 25 of these tanks, some of them the regular ones, some of them special artillery tanks, and some of them heat-seeking tanks. And I got a message from Alfred saying, I'm afraid that was just the beginning, sir. Many, many more on the way to your position. Oh, for fuck's sake.
You don't need the tank stealth sections.
Yeah, I've just got to that. I've only done like two or so, so it hasn't got horrible yet. It's been pretty easy.
Yeah, it gets kind of horrible. those are the worst bits. And it kind of feels like someone's looked at the tank or the car and said, "What could it possibly do? Could it do everything that Batman could do as a person? Like, could it like have platforming sections like Batman does platforming sections? So yeah, oh yeah, maybe if we could put jumps in, yeah. Maybe it can, like, you know how Batman sneaks up behind things and then kind of chokes them. Maybe we could have the Batmobile maybe, just kind of do that. Yeah,
maybe this tank mode Batmobile can do that.
Are there like car sized gargoyles?
In one case for me, it was
statues of cars just jumping out of the buildings.
In one case for me, it was a petrol station. Like, I actually drove through an exploding petrol station in order to stay behind something that I was sneaking up on, which is like, the biggest problem with that system.
Video games.
Yeah.
But the rest of the game, I love the rest of the game. To me, even with those pretty bad sections, like I love so much about the rest of it.
Yeah, it's so good.
It's a really, really good game. Again, caveat being is fucked on PC, obviously, but you can still look at it.
So when it's fixed, it's genuinely amazing. But yeah. And the other thing is that they've... And like the, you know, the first, I think the Arkham Asylum genuinely is a Metroidvania because it's so compartmentalized.
Yeah.
And all systems are compartmentalized. Like, you can try and turn a Predator bit into a fight, but you're probably going to lose. And in loads of different ways, Arkham Knight gives you ways to kind of like curate those sections. So that, like, you get a gadget about in the first, end of the first third of the game-ish that allows you to, you got three shots for it in a given Predator section.
Yeah.
And depending how you want to spend those three shots, you can switch off enemy guns. And if you spend two rounds of ammo on one guy, when he tries to fire the gun, it'll electrocute him and knock him out. And you can also, like, charge ammo crates so that someone tries to get a gun from there, it will fail. And it allows you to do these things where there's, like, five guys in an environment. You disarm three of them, take out the other two silently, and then just, like, drop down between the other three, and it's the, and then turn it into a regular fight, because they'll all go to do the traditional Predator thing of just killing you. And then, one by one, they go, like, shit! And they've recorded so much incidental dialogue for that game that it responds to it in a really organic way. And it's like, Christ! And then you beat the shit out of them. And it feels very bad.
Yeah. Fucking quick.
Yeah, I've done that a few times where I think I prefer the brawling in general to the Predator stuff. Predator stuff is great when it works really well. that was the most banal thing I've ever seen. Every now and then, the Predator thing is great. Most of the time, it's good. And the brawling stuff, in general, I really, really like. So I try to turn Predator fights into brawls if I can. And it's fun to see. I've got that disruptor gun and I've got the three charges for it. You can upgrade it as well to have more charges. So if you wanted to specialize in that, you could. But it's fun for me to see, like, I want to change this into a brawl. I don't necessarily need to take out every gun. Like, even if it's seven guys with guns, if I can disable those three, then the others are relatively isolated. Or they're close together, but I know I can backclaw that guy, and then I'm close enough to the other two to just beat them up, and then the three over there all have disabled guns. And that's actually really satisfying, because it's like, I still get to do the fun beat-em-up bit, but it's kind of built on top of my own plan, and I decided to make it into a fight like this, and I've
succeeded against odds that, you know, feel like they're designed to make this not possible.
Mm. But there are loads of things they've done to the Predator mode to let you just do a sudden Batman more easily. Like, suddenly, there's Batman, you know, thought the guards. So now when you're in these in the grates, which are actually quite big, there's quite a lot of space underground that you can move, and you move fucking fast.
Like, I think you move like faster in the grate than you do in
like, you're like a shark just kind of like...
Yeah, you're like a 6'4" man in a vent, but you're just like pre-sliding.
Yeah, just cutting it around, and your ability to just quickly get around to see an opportunity and get to it really fast, and then pop up right in the middle of them and fuck them all up. Or indeed, just like there are these, the vents can go up to a gargoyle now, so you get this really awesome sequence where you just sort of like bat up to a gargoyle.
Bat up like to the gargoyle, seconds. And from there you can just bat down and bat them all.
Yeah. The thing is, like, you've made a good Batman game if you can replace every verb in that game with Batman.
Yeah, you can tell that in those Predator sections especially, they've done an exceptional job.
They got that fear takedown thing where you can sort of do a stealth attack but also chain it into multiple, not really stealth attacks, more like they just can't do anything about it attacks.
It's spin cell conviction.
Yeah. And it's, you have to charge it by doing a regular stealth takedown. And I found myself refusing to use it after a time. Like, I used it the first couple of times because you have to. And then I felt like, but that's just cheating. I just took out all three of them, but I didn't get a surprise attack on those. They were just... I'm just Batman, so I won the fight.
I actually really like it. Like, I mean, because Spin Cell Conviction had the thing where... But it didn't make any sense in that game. Like,
Mark can execute, yeah.
Yeah,
Mark can execute. Why he would suddenly be able to shoot three people.
It's like, oh, God, I
punch somebody.
Feels so energized by snapping that guy.
Yeah. I just need to garrote a man before I can... Oh, now I'm feeling it. You know, I'm in the zone. Like, it doesn't make any sense, whereas in the Batman case, it's called fear. Like, the buff you get that allows you to do it is called fear. And so the idea is that... After you've silently taken somebody out, the rest of them are now in this state of fear that allows you to exploit their fear. Which
really, for it to really make sense, they should have to find the body. Because if they don't find the body, how do they even know anything?
But normally, like, the boss of the area tells them, because, oh, that's another guy down, idiots. Yeah, just, like, oh, shit.
As I said, like, the amount of crazy, random, incidental dialogue in the game is nuts, like, for people explaining things. But I really like it because you have that moment where you've like strung one guy up from the ceiling and then like, and that gives you the buff. Or actually stringing them up doesn't, but like you choke someone out, string another guy up, they all run to see the person you strung up from the ceiling. And then you drop down and like slow-mo fuck up four of them. And it's like, it's very Batman.
And then suddenly, Batman.
Yeah.
And they're all fucked. Yeah, it's great. There's probably a lot more I can say about why it's great.
I had a lot of frustrations with the punching stuff. Past a certain point when they introduce a thing where medics can electrify a man and that electrified man can't be punched. It's not so much... So all of Batman's combat really... Like, the basic level is you attack or you counter. And if you're just about to be hit, it's probably better to counter. Or if you aren't confident you can intentionally land the blow on that particular guy, then it's best to counter because the counter will work no matter which way you're facing everything. But if you have space to maneuver, then you... attack and you choose who you want to attack and you can kind of pace it that way, and then the combos build up and you do special moves on that, and then that's really good fun but maybe too basic. So they keep adding there's this type of enemy and this guy's immune to your attacks or is immune to your counters and therefore you must use this ability, and I like that for like special case number one. I like it for special case number two, special case number three, special case number four, as long as he doesn't come along too often. We only get to like special case 17. And they all, like, the electrified guys just broke the camel's back for me because A, they're, it's just like one thing too many to think about and to counter. B, they've done, I don't think it's actually a rule change, but the way that counter indicators, are set up and the types of enemies you're facing is different enough in Arkham Knight that the way I used to play Arkham City doesn't apply anymore, which was with Arkham City, the counter indicator told me what to do. So if it was a blue counter indicator, I can just press the counter button. If it's a red counter indicator, then,
jump
that
over
was,
and hit from behind.
Yeah, it was either a shield guy or a taser guy, and both of those, the same things work. And if it was a yellow counter indicator, then it's a knife guy, so you can counter it, but it's going to be tricky. And in Arkham Knight, there are about four different kinds of enemies that all just do the red counter indicator. And the solution in every case is totally different. If they're charging towards you, you have to do the batarang thing. Nothing else will work. Counter doesn't work. Jumping out of the way doesn't work. They just teleport to you and automatically get you. The electrified guys, most of the normal counters don't work. And the only thing you can do is fire your grappling hook into them and then pull them towards you. And it turns out the grappling hook can discharge
them. I think it hurts them.
I was just like, ah. why? And so it's counterintuitive, and also the indicators are the same. And I just, the way I got good at Arkham City's combat was I just sort of hard-coded my muscle memory to the colours I was seeing on the screen. So I'm like, blue do this, yellow do this, red do this. And now I can't do that, it's just red. I don't know. Ah, fuck!
It's funny because I feel kind of the same way, but like I played Arkham Knight, Arkham Asylum to death before City came out, and I played Arkham, and they changed this, but like in the hard mode of Arkham Asylum, there were no indicators. So yeah. You had to read the weapon, like in order to know what the counter was.
I tried it once.
And so, and City made it a little clearer and prevented you from switching off the indicators because they became more important. You couldn't switch them off. And as a result, I sort of now play half and half. Like I don't necessarily fully trust the indicators. I see the game as basically fundamentally Rock Band, and it's about like how Rock Band trains you, and initially when you play on easy, you use two colours, and then it trains you to use five, and later, you know, modifiers and multiple colours and other things. It's the same thing of like, every different enemy type is a different note you learn to play, and the sea of rando dudes around you is the fretboard on which you orchestrate your Batman solo.
Wow, a sea. And a guitar metaphor in one.
So, yeah. Thanks, man.
The sea of rando dudes.
I think
rando number five.
Yeah, nice. Yeah, a little bit of Monica.
I think in some ways, Arkham Knight, for me, is suffering from the fact that Arkham City was so good at letting you play the way you wanted to. Not just in terms of, like, you can play through the main game the way you want to, but... the challenge rooms, it just gave you so many to choose from, and not just like, do you want to play a brawling challenge or do you want to play a predator challenge, but of the brawling challenges, which kind of enemies do you want to face? So I was able to just play the ones that didn't have this kind of, certain kind of enemy that I found frustrating to counter. And so I could just pick, or I just, you know, I want it to be hard, but I only want to fight knife guys and armored guys and maybe some shield guys and taser guys, but none of the massive guys who have this other rule I don't like. So I was able to basically pick and choose the game mechanics that I enjoyed in that, and then just play that endlessly. And also I got to choose who to play as, so I figured out that I like Catwoman best, and just played as Catwoman against these enemies just again and again and again for like a year. And so I really, really like that, and everything else that's not that is slightly disappointing to me.
The co-op combat stuff is amazing and I love it. I wish it's so good. Kind of more of it in a way, especially like, there's a co-op predator section that's fucking brilliant as well, and yeah, hopefully they'll do more of that in the DLC.
So I've done the Catwoman bits in Arkham Knight at the very end. And I've got some Nightwing side quests. Who else is there? Robin, right? Is he a side quest or is he in the main quest?
You'll find out as you progress through the story.
What I want to know is when I'm playing it, like, should I just carry on the main quest to get to those co-op bits, or should I look for side quests?
Main quest has co-op bits.
Right.
Really fucking good ones. Graham. You've not been playing anything?
Nope.
Chris, what have you been playing?
I went back to Team Fortress. Really weirdly. Actually, before I talk about that, I was going to talk briefly about Infinity Factory, because it's a really quick one. Because I spoke about it, I think, when it went on Early Access, and it was this really weird example of a game that came out on Early Access and was basically finished and brilliant. In that it had a full campaign, it was fucking great, and still is, and I did our Early Access review, we don't put a score on the end, and it's like, I feel like this is... I want to give this more prizes than I can.
He said when he released it that the game was at the stage at which he would normally just release a game, but since Early Access existed, he may as well put it out in that, and then do the post-release patching before release.
But it's not even that. So yeah, it got some updates and some tweaks and fixes, but like in terms of just like actual improvements to the base game, two puzzles were tweaked. And they added a group select tool to allow you to move groups of blocks at once. This is a game where you create factories out of Minecraft style components or Infiniminer style components, depending on how pointed you want to be. it's a quality of life thing, really, really minor. What they've actually done with the time since then and now is added three mini campaigns, which all take place in like the epilogue of the campaign and would collectively easily amount to like one or several DLC packs for the main game. Like they feel fundamentally like the expansion to Infiniminer. Like Infinity Factory has a start, a finish, and a start and an end that is quite satisfying as a campaign that came out in Early Access. And now it has this really substantial bolt-on at the end that has new blocks and new tools and some crazy stuff. So it's really fucking good, basically. Probably the best puzzle game released this year.
I think he also made a new game Yeah, like, yeah, even before he released Infinity Factory.
Yeah. Came out in early access.
Made
him 2 weeks ago.
TI 300 or something?
Something like that. It's about programming.
They're programming the assembly language, I think, which I haven't even touched it, but I think it's the hardest core of things.
I think there's a law now that all puzzle game designers must at some point go, programming's a bit like puzzles. Maybe I could make a game about that. And then make a game about that.
I think there's a rule that on some schedule, Zach Bart has to come make a game that's completely only for geniuses and then make like Ironclad Tactics and Infinity Factory and then go back to like a space chem or, you know, programming game. But yeah, there's some, like, I don't have a huge amount to say about it because it's just more good Infinity Factory, but like, there's some cool things, like it adds a teleporter, which is a single block that teleports between two levels, basically. So you can move through it and you can move blocks through it. And it allows this completely different kind of puzzle design where, you've got it, you know, the input will be on one dimension and the output will be in a different dimension with a single block teleporter separating them. But it only teleports one block at a time. And when they go through to the other side, they no longer are attached to whatever they were attached to before you can, so even though you can feed an entire design into it, it will come out back in its component parts. And so this kind of like disassembly, reassembly rhythm thing you've got to set up, like that game is partly about train set construction and partly about machinery design, and that kind of getting that right is incredibly gratifying. It's really hard to explain, but it's just really fucking good. So buy Infinity Factory because it's probably the second best game this year.
What's the first?
Invisible Ink.
Hey!
What's the second? Let's just go down the list.
Batman.
That's good. Her story's good.
Her story.
Is that four?
Yeah, maybe Her Story's three. But Batman's fixed, it'll have a proper
Which
chat.
Is the greatest detective in the world. You or Batman.
Exactly. Yeah.
Or the detectives who are interviewing the lady in Her Story. Yeah. We don't see them, but they're probably the best detectives in the world.
Yeah, they're much better than us.
That's a clip that no one finds. The point when suddenly Batman appears, punches the lady.
It is Batman, that's the twist.
Yeah, the fucking counter-indicator appears above her head.
He hasn't asked any questions, she's just been sitting there in his cowl and she just spilled the whole thing.
That actually changes the entire context of Her Story. Batman is the interview.
It's like that scene from the Nolan film where the lights go out and then they come back on.
She totally, because there's a bit, there are, you know, parts where she talks to the detective.
Yeah.
You know, like, you know, do you have any kids or whatever, detective? You just dub that as like, no.
Yeah. I had parents once.
Where is the other Simon going? What the fuck was I talking about? Oh yeah, so I went back to TF2 today for like an hour, which is apparently what I do every year is go back to TF2, and I'm happy to report that game still makes no fucking sense.
This is for the metal?
Gunmetal update.
Gunmetal update.
What does it feel like these days? Because I remember when I was playing it and they're adding all this crazy shit, I got up to like Mad Milk, I think was one of the most recently added things. I remember someone else saying, I just came back to TF2 after a break, I don't know what the fuck's going on, I'm covered in milk and I'm angry. And I didn't feel that then, but then when I've gone back to it since, I am a bit like, what's going on now?
Really funny because it's like, it's completely fucking baffling. Like, so there are loads more taunts now, like, so the animations you can do that are sometimes dependent on your weapon, but there's now like other ones you can buy, and some of them are group taunts. So if someone has like an interact icon above their heads, then you can go up to them and press the interact button, and you can like play rock paper scissors with them, whatever in the match. And one of them is like a conga line, and like infinite players could join in on the conga line until everybody is in the conga line.
Even enemy players?
No, I think it's allies. But like, and everyone's going like conga, 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 and like because there's that, and it's probably designed for that like minute period where you're waiting for the gates to open at the start of the match. But like, I play medic most of the time, and that period is actually quite important for medic, because you can charge ubercharge, which is like the thing that makes people invulnerable, by healing people constantly during that period. And I realized that I'd fucked it, because I'd spent the entire minute period before the match, like dancing around in the spawn room. And it's like, what the fuck is this game anymore? Right? And but on one hand, so it's totally baffling, you don't know what half the fucking guns do, you now have, I bought the ticket because I wanted to see what the event was, and the event gives you these contracts, which are basically just daily quests, like if you've played any game that has any kind of like kill X of this class type optional objective, then you know what it is. And that gets you unique guns that each come with a unique skin, which is randomly assigned, which you can inspect using the Counter-Strike style inspect my gun button.
Admire my custom gun.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know they'd added that to TF2.
They just
did. But it is the greatest thing in game. Yeah. It just makes sense. Every counter-terrorist soldier into this gormless idiot who's just staring at the paintwork at his own gun like,
whoa, I got look at this, bro.
I got a fucking awful tartan medi gun. but nothing makes any fucking sense. And then you realise that actually, whatever class you're playing, most of the time, the thing you need to do is relatively simple. Like, it's not a vastly complicated game. You're shooting the gun at the man, or if you're the medic, you're firing the Healy pipe at a man, and you're not going too far wrong if you're just doing that. So I kind of got back into it and, you know, doing okay in the scoreboard just by doing the very basic TF2 thing. But it's still surrounded by just noise in a way that is completely unlike any other game I can think of. Like, it's really like, it feels like it's just been fucking, it feels like a shoebox full of somebody's lunch that's been left for like a year. And you're like, oh god, like this, you know, civilization has developed just in hats. That is completely alien to me, and I'm sure people get a huge amount out of it, and I kind of like going back to it, but it feels almost quite nihilistic in a way, because you go back in and just have your experience of it, which is like, I got bored of playing medic, so, and I like the sniper with a bow, the huntsman. Mm. So I went back to just plonking arrows at people for a bit, and I did that until we won or lost, and nothing felt like it meant anything.
I do that every few months as well, and no matter how much TF2 changes around me, that experience of just being a huntsman with a bow and arrow is still enormously satisfying. Like, it's just, bows are always great in games, and headshots in TF2 particularly are just brilliant.
It's because war never changes, Graham.
bows never changes.
It's what baffles me is that there's not a classic mode, is there? There's no way to just, like, play the original TF2, which is just bizarre.
Except on Xbox.
It would just seem to be the easiest thing in the world to do. And then they put so much effort into making each of the classes
identifiable from their silhouettes, and that was a big thing when it first came out.
Every weapon was identifiable at just a glance and stuff like that. Like, that was part of how they marketed that game, was talking about their design processes and the stuff that they'd done.
And that was just gorgeous gibberish.
A pile of seven different hats on top of that silhouette, and made that an all-class hat that anyone can wear.
Well, wearing a mask that's designed to tie in with the release of Shogun 2 Total War.
Yeah, there's two alien isolation sets. One's for the scout, which makes you look like an alien, and one's for the pyro, that makes you look like a terrified member of the Nostromo crew, the flamethrower. And scouts do more melee damage, and they do more melee damage to each other's sets. So if one person's wearing the full Nostromo set, they take more damage from the xenomorph, and the xenomorph takes more flame damage from the... And it's like, at this point, like, I mean, you know, people say Dota's complicated. But, like, you know, Dota's this rule that, like, you know, cosmetics aren't allowed to interfere with the game. Sometimes you go like, oh shit, like, that character didn't look like a pagoda before. Like, why do they look like a pagoda now? But you always know what their abilities are and kind of how they relate to you, whereas, like, I got, like, 3 drops today in the time I spent with TF2. And every time I looked at it, I went, I understand half of this. Like, it's a new flamethrower, but it does more damage under this circumstance than this modifier, and it's got this, and it might be strange or genuine or something like this. And it obviously means a lot to people, and so I don't want to say it's full number wang, because I think people would say that of Dota, and I know Dota is a number wang. Dota is serious maths. But
TF2 feels more like Calvin Ball. That stage of just anything goes, we're making it up. But then at the same time, it feels like each individual interaction is satisfying enough that maybe it just doesn't matter.
Yeah. I think you just log in to do your thing, whatever that is, and, like, it doesn't really matter. Like, there was some guy today in chat going, like, oh my god, there are 3 spies, why don't you all go kill yourselves? And the entire chat was like, don't take this so seriously, man, it's just a game. And you'd never get that at Dota, right?
That was the wonderful thing about TF2 when it first started as well, because it already had that element. Like, you were coming to it probably from, like, Counter-Strike, which was Valve's last big multiplayer shooter, in which everyone was accusing everyone of cheating all the time. And then you came to TF2, in which you killed someone and then you waved to mock them, and it took a bunch of that nastiness and either rendered it inert by just turning it into a joke, or made the nastiness, like, an explicitly funny part of the mechanics of the game. Like, that was that kind of genius. And so I guess maybe it has held true to that part of his design, if nothing else.
It's interesting that if you have the alien set, is that, like, it makes you look like the alien itself? Because there's also the face hugger from Alien Swarm is another cosmetic item in TF2. So the face huggers from Alien Swarm can now meet the aliens inspired them.
Dad? Yeah. And the comics are still really good for some reason. Like, it's Jay Pinkton that writes them. And like...
It's the person who draws them, because each one is like hundreds of pages long.
Yeah.
And it's just released in a giant bulk.
And they're so amazing.
There is just an artist that, at Valve who just draws TF2 comics.
Yeah, and they started doing Dota comics as well, but like, the TF2 comics are genuinely great.
Yeah.
And they have really nothing to do with that game. Like, they used to announce an update or introduce some new game type or something, but they're just very funny comics that are vaguely related to a multiplayer game that resembles them not at all. So like, TF2 obviously entertains me over the course of a year loads, because like, just their blog posts are amazing.
Mm.
But I don't know what it is. Why are you TF2?
I love the fact that it's like, we all used to play TF2 pretty religiously.
Yeah.
And it's now about 8 times more popular than it was when any of us last played it seriously. Like, it's a juggernaut. It's still like, what, the biggest game?
Third after CSGO, yeah.
Because I always think of it as like, in its twilight now, it's kind of over, you know? Yeah. I mean, I know they're adding stuff and that's cool, and it's nice that some people still enjoy it, but it's still just a little tiny little
niche thing. 2007, peaked in 2010, so since.
That isn't actually what the numbers say.
I think about Titanfall a lot these days, after playing a lot of Destiny and playing things like TF2, and like what it takes to actually keep people playing the shooter. And like Titanfall,
fucking hats, man.
Yeah, it's. I think it's just change. Like, Titanfall feels fucking great. Like, that's got some
it's great
shotguns. Yeah. It's just a great game. Traversal is amazing in that game. You can call down fucking robots on people's heads. It's great. And I played it for a month and was done with it forever.
Me too, pretty much. They changed it a whole bunch, but mostly by removing modes and maps from it, because they didn't have the audience to sustain them, and so it was screwing up the matchmaking.
Right.
And so this was a game that you bought for $50 that then gradually over time melted like an ice cube. Until there was very little of it left. They took away my favourite mod. You know, like, Capture the Flag was the thing.
Yeah, that was the best one of that game.
They got rid of it.
Why has Capture the Flag been so, so sort of cut out of FPS development? Because it feels like every game has a capture point mode. Or like a kind of, or a, you know, tug of war, push the cart sort of thing. But CTF is still like the best competitive format for shooters, right? Like,
People seem to disagree, because, I mean, on Titanfall, there's evidence at least people don't play Capture the Flag.
Is it because it's better than them?
It was, I remember it being sort of stagnated in TF2. Like, it was originally one of the main modes with,
T4 with scouts going across the rooftops.
Yeah,
and stuff,
I remember, what were the other CTF maps other than 2-4?
Well.
Which were both remakes.
Well, was good.
I learned from TFC, because I had such a different relationship with TFC to TF2. But,
The 2-4 always, it would just end up in like a sniper war, and it kind of got a reputation for being like the stagnant map where everyone just stays in their base and...
But I like being stagnant.
I think it's really good, but then, I think Payload was in part designed to...
Yeah. Like in TF2, I would rather play Payload, I think. But Titanfall, with its traversal mechanics, which make it really compelling to move through those environments and move through those environments quickly, and with the ability to call down enormous mechs that you don't have to pilot, you can put on automatic mode. Those are two things that change the experience, basically, of capturing a flag and getting out of that area. Like the fact that you can call down a mech, and as it's falling from the sky, swoop down, grab it, and then parkour your way out of there while your mech keeps the defenses at bay.
Yeah.
Like, that's a really cool thing. Which no other mode in Titanfall quite allowed for in the same way.
It's interesting. It's like, the only other game that never really lost its CTF mode because it couldn't is Tribes.
Mm.
And Tribes is both the best and least popular competitive online shooter. Which is why, and therefore encapsulating the spirit of CTF in a single bundle that nobody fucking plays, and it's the best game.
What I like about CTF, well, one of the things, other than it being a great game mode, this isn't what I like about CTF. An interesting fact about CTF is that it was a mod. It was created by, I think, a guy called Three Toe. It was a quick mod for Quake World that,
I mean, it's,
that
it's a...
then Ed adopted and turned into an official mode for Quake 2, and then just spread throughout the industry from there.
It's also like a real thing, right? Like,
Yeah, it's a game.
I don't think armies generally beat each other by capturing each other's flag.
No, I don't mean it's a real simulation of war. I mean, it's a real game that people play in real life.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no reason it couldn't be.
But then, Titanfall like shrunk and dwindled, and who knows how many people actually play it now. TF2 has obviously thrived, and Destiny thrives because they constantly changed and Iron Banner.
Destiny's getting CTF though. We can't talk about it. Yeah, in the expansion. Oh, and it sounds fucking amazing. They've actually made Chapter 5 better. Do you know why? I'm going to console land briefly, but so the idea is you get it's the CTF variant where there's one flag, so it's one flag CTF with a goal in each base, right? Mm. But you've got to cap it in the enemy's base. So you've got to get this orb from the center of the map and cap it in the enemy's base. So it's kind of basketball, but you get so many points for capturing it forwards. But if you do a backwards backflip into it and dunk it behind your head, you get more points for capturing. Game of Forever. Yeah. Still the best game. Game of Forever.
I love Destiny.
There are two cool variants of CTF. One of which is Clone Bandits, the mod for UT 2004, which always deserved to be its own game, I think. It was really brilliant. As far as I know, it was only one map. I think they had others planned, but it was a combination of capture points and CTF, where the clones were the things you could capture, but also the points you captured to control of would constantly produce like a certain resource, and you could steal clones from the capture points, I think, to like instantly capture them. And it was just a really good mashup of those, and it also had its own really cool, unique style. And then the other one was UT3, which might have been the same mechanic, where there was like a flag, but it was kind of a key piece in a strategy map of control points, and taking the flag to a control point would instantly cap it instead of having to slowly cap it. And you could take it in vehicles and stuff. UT3 was really good, and no one else thinks this.
I really miss the day when there were just lots of multiplayer modes, either with games or as mods to games. Because what was the... Yeah. Was it UT2003 that had a mode where you were trying to take a ball and dump it in a giant pit in the enemy's base? Ooh, what was that called?
There's Bombing Run. There's also Death Ball, although that might have been a mod.
Death Ball was a mod. I think Bombing Run was the one where you used the impact hammer or almost like a gravity gun to pick up the ball and try and spit it into the enemy's base pit. And that was really fun. And what was the... Started off as a mod, but then it was an official mode in Quake 3 Team Arena, where you would kill enemies and then you could pick up their skulls that would float behind you and then you had to like bank them in order to score points.
Bank the skulls.
It was like bananas. Weakest link, but did you rocket launchers.
The weakest skull. The weakest cranium.
What was your analogy?
Bananas in Diddy Kong Racing.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure that's how exactly the same mechanic.
Yep. I can't remember what that was called, but that was
There's
great.
Also Jailbreak, which is a mod for UT2. Dead players go to your team's jail, or dead enemies go to your team's jail, and then if someone can get to their own jail, they can free all of their teammates. So it's like elimination, but with a chance for the survivors to rescue the other people. That just led to such cool moments.
That was a Quake 2 mod originally.
Really?
And then there was, for Half-Life, Science and Industry.
Yeah, I was going to mention Science.
Which took the idea, and it was about kidnapping scientists from the enemies and putting them in your own base so that they would research better weapons for you.
I think you could have them research better caffeine that would make them more productive.
Yeah.
This is the thing. So this stuff might actually come back. Like...
With Unity and with UE4 being free.
I was also going to say with Unreal, the new Unreal Tournament being what it is.
Yeah.
And on the flip side, Dota Reborn being what it is, where it's all about making custom games. Like, on different ends of the spectrum, like the tools are kind of coming back to kind of get this sort of stuff back. Because what it requires is like, you need small communities of people willing to play this. You don't need it to be the mode that the masses want to play. Like, Titanfall probably got rid of CTF because they couldn't sell map packs off the basis of it because they were already doing a tremendous job of cutting hard lines into their community by selling premium map packs, which is the worst thing you can do to a shooter. And, you know, so they basically fucked it long before they got to the point where something like CTF could be viable. But you only need 20 people who want to play it for it to be viable enough of the time to be worth it. And it's like, it's really exciting to get that back because... It's a weird instance of genres going backwards, that the competitive FPS is far less varied now than it was a decade and a half ago.
There's been a couple of interesting first-person multiplayer games we've talked about in the pod that I'll mention now purely so we can link them in the show notes. One was Intruder 2 that we all played together.
Do you mean just Intruder, right?
Yes. I'm getting mixed up with Intrusion 2. Yeah. Intruder, which is... beta first-person tactical game about trying to steal a bit of intelligence from the enemy and then escape the level. But it does really interesting things, Rainbow Six-y type things. For example, the fact that you can overhear other people talking in the environment as they're chatting over voice comms. So as you're crawling through the vents, you have to be whispering to your teammates over the radio. The radio is a physical item you have to hold in your hand and squeeze the button in order to chat. And if there is someone underneath that vent while you're talking on the enemy team, they can hear you and overhear your plan, and vice versa. The other one I've just completely forgotten the name of, which was a first-person game I played, which isn't out yet, which is about
one team room.
Yeah, one team is defending.
Oh yeah,
And the other team is attacking, and you can blow open.
Yeah,
I think it's called something and something, but not hide and seek, not breach and clear.
Fighting crowbar?
Yeah, that's the name of it.
Well, show and notes.
I will, yes. And that, you know, it takes the asymmetry of the best, like, Rainbow Six Rogue Spear levels and turns it into a multiplayer thing. And then the thing that's impressive about it is that it manages to compact that experience down into 3 to 5 minute long rounds, which is the thing that Counter-Strike does that makes Counter-Strike so popular, which more tactical games always really struggle with. And it does that without getting rid of the planning phase like Rainbow Six does, without getting rid of all the different tools and equipment that you can use in a Rainbow Six game. And that game is really cool.
If only we knew what it was called.
Yes, yes indeed. I'm sure we will know one day, and it will be written on the blog, creativecrowbar.com.
Shall we do questions? From questions?
Yes, we should.
After this break. And we're back. And before we go to questions, I'd like to specially thank Richard Jacket, who is the man whose name I couldn't remember earlier, who sent me £20, which is still in my PayPal account. But I have bought booze, so it's kind of like I have also spent his money. But nobody else has seen the proceeds from that. So it's kind of like I just have stolen it. But for the benefit of the podcast, anyway, thank you, Richard Jacket.
Thank you, Richard Jacket. Yeah,
I think if you ever purchase booze for the podcast at any point in the future, it counts as that going towards it, right?
Yeah.
Because money is liquid. No one can trace it. That's what my accountant tells me, and that's why I get away with it.
Again, that's why you should trust us with your Patreon donations. But on to questions.
Ethical interlude over.
Alex writes, "Dear Creighton Quoggins."
That's a Guild Wars thing.
Wielding crowbars. Crate is spelled K-R-A-I-T.
That's also a Guild Wars thing.
Okay.
Wow, double Guild Wars. It's almost like it's about Guild Wars 2.
"Dear Creighton Quoggins, wielding crowbars. It has been almost a week since Lion's Arch, the main hub city in Guild Wars 2, was rebuilt, bringing with it sweeping balance changes, a reworked build system, a harbour modelled after a lobster, an octopus-shaped bank, and a deliciously tricky city-wide rooftop jumping puzzle. I believe Chris very much enjoyed Guild Wars 2 at launch. With an expansion coming at some point this year, has that rekindled any desire to jump back in? There seems to be a general vibe within the community of players that the expansion is too small and will take too long to come out. I've never really been a part of other MMO communities. Is this a common sentiment shared by many games communities in the quiet before the pre-launch ramp-up? Is ArenaNet cocking up the marketing, or is it just an unremarkable expansion? Thanks, Alex."
So, first answer is yes, I do actually want to stop playing Guild Wars 2 again, because I got the level cap and the old stuff and didn't do much of the living story update thing that they did, to fill in, like, between Guild Wars 2 as it launched and now. They did an actual kind of ongoing series of events and story stuff that you can do, like, sort of timey-wimey time portal stuff to go back and see if you want to play it after the fact.
Really?
But the idea is that if you, you know, played it at the time, then you got to see the story of, like, the main city in the world getting completely destroyed. And, you know, it's now been rebuilt, and that's what he's gesturing at. So yeah, I do want to go back. Heart of Thorns, which is the expansion, which is not Heart of the Storm. Heroes of the Storm. Heart of the Storm.
Heroes of the Heart Storm.
Heart Storm. Thorns. Heart, Heart of Thorns. is the first premium expansion the game has had, and I think It's kind of interesting because ArenaNet asked for far less money for their MMO than any other developer has.
Mm.
That, and this is one of the reasons, I mean, I rate it highly because I genuinely think it's the best MMO ever made.
Mm.
From its combat system to the stuff that exists independently of its business model down to the fact that you pay often, because they have sales on all the time, 20 quid for the base game and you get the whole thing forever. And despite the microtransaction store, but then again, WoW has a microtransaction store now. Everything has a microtransaction store. This is the first time, this expansion, that the community's been asked to pay up again. Whereas if this had been a traditional MMO, they would have paid 10 times more by now, simply in subscription fees. Mm. It puts them in a kind of weird position, because not only did they do that, where they had the game released on this very generous model, they also did more substantial updates over time than most subscription MMOs do, because they're living world stuff where they constantly added events and bosses and an ongoing story. No other MMO really does. So there's no way they can put out this expansion and it doesn't feel like part of what they've already, the community's already used to getting for free.
Yeah.
So they've almost weirdly shot themselves in the foot with it, whereas they were kind of too generous with the free stuff, which was genuinely free because it wasn't just like bundled with your subscription or anything.
Yeah.
It
doesn't, like, to me, it doesn't sound that insubstantial for an expansion. This new kind of weapon combinations for different classes.
Yeah, there's loads of new subclasses.
New race, and a whole new zone. There's this standard stuff, a level cap raise. Well, not a level cap raise, actually. They're doing something. There's an additional leveling system they're working in, which is...
Yeah, flight and stuff like that. Yeah.
I think his second question is, like, is this normal griping for an MMO community? And I think it is. Like, if you are a World of Warcraft player or any other MMO player, and you're the type that are posting on the forum, then you are the type that will have burnt through the expansion content within a week, and you will have hit the new level cap, and you will have conquered the new raids, and you will have got the new stuff, and you'll be like, oh. Mm. But the thing is that I don't think most MMO players are like that, and I think there are probably a larger number of Guild Wars players that are like you, Chris, where they played it a whole bunch, and even if they loved it, they hit the level cap, and then they put it to one side, and they're looking forward to an excuse to return to it. Mm. And they won't burn through it in the space of 5 days.
Yeah. It's also, I mean, griping is normal, I would say. This is kind of new to an extent to Guild Wars because, you know, there's this sort of affrontedness that people are being asked to pay again for something. But compared to, like, every other MMO on the planet, like, it's such good value. And the fact that it's just a better game.
How much is Heart of Thorns?
I don't know. It includes the base game. That was something that included... It
includes the base game?
Yeah.
Oh.
So that's something
that's why people are angry, I think.
Yeah, this
because
is really
you can't. The price for getting that and the
money. Oh my god, because they think they can get it cheaper if they.
Yeah.
Oh god,
it's the. Yeah, this is something problem. That I'd love to address head on, because the same thing affects the Destiny community, although Bungie made some other mistakes. The thing is, right, for the health of that game, the expansion should include the base game. Because otherwise you risk dividing the community.
Yeah.
And that is such an obvious thing, right? And everyone, especially with that game as it's designed, the thing that's wonderful about that game is that it's a rare example of MMO that gets better the more players are involved. Most MMOs are fucked if multiple players involve themselves in the same activity. They either have to instance something off to preserve the experience of a few players, or they have to give you some kind of complex, very solipsistic quest system where only you are engaged in your objective, so you complete it off. Guild Wars works on a system where however many players involve themselves in an activity, the activity scales to match the involvement of the players, which is how literally every MMO should work. Because if you're making a massively multiplayer game and multiple players involving themselves in an activity is a bad thing, you have fucked it. It's like making a racing game where going fast breaks it. This FPS, we don't really want to fire the gun.
Don't be in first person. Come on, man.
Yeah, like,
work with us.
You know, you've dicked it, basically. You've dicked the pudding. That's not a real phrase, but whatever. The point, like, and Guild Wars gets it right, and to preserve that, like, the best thing that happened to Guild Wars isn't just an expansion, it's a proper resurgence of new players.
Mm.
Like, that brings the whole game back to life, because there are zones in that game that feel a bit lifeless when there aren't people there to spur the events along and kind of, like, you know, bring the kind of, like, scripted stuff to life that can happen. So the best thing that could possibly happen is Guild Wars gets a shitload of new players all at once. So they, of course they bundle it, but the community's annoyed because they feel like they should have to pay. They should be paying
less.
But they're getting absolutely the same amount everyone else is out of it, honestly. Like, because they're getting their game back.
How much does the Destiny expansion cost?
40 quid.
40 quid?
Okay. Yeah. It's actually the same size as the base game, which is weird.
Interesting.
But you don't get the base game, right?
Not with that bundle, no. You pay like 60 quid, which is like console regular game price for the expansion plus the base game.
That's interesting.
Or is it?
Charlie writes, Dear CNC, a few weeks ago you guys talked about the potential fallout of permanent body augmentations becoming taboo or falling out of fashion, and you wondered what this would look like. Well, this has already happened. Foot binding was a near universal practice that made a woman both desirable and eligible for marriage. Then times changed. As China became more industrialized, the practice was outlawed. But you cannot unbind a lotus foot. Worse, the cultural norm shifted and women were expected to work the fields. This was traditionally men's work, which is difficult if you cannot walk great distances or stand for long without pain.
Oh, Jesus.
Many women were seen as living relics of a past age for the rest of their lives. So sorry for the downer. This might help if ludonarrative dissonance drink here early.
I need this drink now.
Was abbreviated to LD, would you guys still have to drink? Well, no, I guess not, because we're not drinking a second time now. Charlie?
Yeah, I think it's different, though, because in all the instances of augmentation that we were talking about, they communicated a very great benefit to that person, not just in terms of their kind of social standing with some kind of arbitrary system as imposed by, you know, whenever 13th century China or something like that, but, like, you know, people who are augmented in the world of Deus Ex are just better at all the things that they do. And that was the reason that it's hard to imagine it suddenly becoming taboo, because those people would be in the power structures which enable them to assert dominance. Whereas women who have their feet smashed up, not so
it
much.
Is, you know,
there are interesting situations maybe when it comes to people who are, for example, deaf, who can then get, say, cochlear implants that allow them to hear. But what that often does is it doesn't allow them to hear well enough to seamlessly integrate with the hearing society, but it allows them to hear well enough that it alienates them from deaf society. So there is still this sense of you were part of this group, but now you have augmented yourself in such a way that you have progressed such that you are now alienated from the society that you were once a part of. And there are people who then choose to have those cochlear implants removed because it is destructive to their identity in some way. So there are maybe still examples similar sort of scenarios within society.
Definitely. I think it was me who, in the last podcast, was talking about the... I was kind of defending the mechanical apartheid thing and saying I found the idea quite compelling that you'd get this permanent change to your body that you, at the time, seemed like just a win-win-win and was a greatly respected thing. And then the sort of semi-horror of that suddenly becoming something that's frowned upon and everyone hates because of some... societal change, and I agree that this is a good example of that that really has happened, and that, you know, people did that to advance their social status and or because they're forced to, and then we're left in a situation where they're suddenly frowned upon for something that wasn't really their choice or that they weren't able to make an informed decision about, and that's a kind of horror that I find compelling, maybe is horror the right word, maybe.
I think it is.
Tragedy, maybe.
Phrased in those terms, I mean, it sounds almost like, you know, like soldiers who went off to war during Vietnam and came back thinking that they would be heroes as people who fought in World War II were, but were instead spat on because Vietnam was an extremely unpopular war.
And came back with horrible chemical addictions. which is quite similar to the idea, because Deus Ex put forward the idea that those kind of augmentations are being forced upon people or made so cheap that they're commonly available. For some ulterior motive, obviously, in Deus Ex, it's all about conspiracy. But in the same way that, you know, the army tried to experiment on soldiers in Vietnam and obviously left them with terrible scars.
Funny, because it's also like, it's analogous to something that's going on in Deus Ex 1, but it's not quite the same, where Deus Ex 1, you're a nano-augmented agent, and mechanically augmented agents like Jensen are the fucking relics, and they're all just idiots. They're just like, oh, you got all your arms replaced with robo-arms for your better agent, you fucking moron. If it took 10 years, you could have had seamless integration, where you still get to be a normal functioning member of society, and you get all the badass shit.
And that's why doctors get fucked.
And that's why Gunther and Anna resent you in Deus Ex.
Mm. Yeah, I'd say, because I did a video on this, and as I was editing it, because the production practices of editing videos are new to me and I'm stupid, I realised that by the time I got to the end of editing it, I didn't really agree with it. And in fact, I think, I kind of agree in the large part. Like, the ideas of, you know, the kind of ideas of how games handle power or not very good at handling disempowerment, which we'll come to later, I think there's another question on that.
Mm.
And also the idea of how kind of wounded heroes actually reinforce the hegemony by encouraging people who have power to feel sorry for themselves, rather than encouraging empathy. I think those things are true, but I think actually Deus Ex is probably the wrong example to draw them from, because I think it does a lot of things through the storyline to mitigate that stuff and also mechanically. And so just forget that video, really. It's rubbish now.
No! I paid for that video. I think you find it's very good. And you should subscribe to youtube.com/rockpeppershot.
Well, I haven't invoiced for it yet, so you could just change your mind.
All right, fair enough. Wow. If you're giving it to us for free, that's fine.
My commission.
Games Journalism Live.
You could have meant to read out another question, but you're pouring yourself a drink.
I was going to say that there was a video released today of Metal Gear Solid 5, The Phantom Pain, and it's an alternate playthrough of the same missions, or roughly the same missions, as the E3 2015 demo, which
wasn't
was
that like 40 minutes long.
Yeah, it's 40 minutes long, and this one is 31
like,
minutes
like
long.
More of this?
It's 31 minutes long, and it does mostly the same videos, but it approaches them in a different way. And one of the ways in which it approaches it, which is different, is that and it's all narrated in Japanese, this, but at one point Big Boss launches a rocket fist.
Of course.
Which is a remote-controlled rocket fist that he then flies, like a redeemer from Unreal Tournament, into this Afghan base, into a building, through corridors, dodging past guards, to punch a man in the back of the head, at which point it explodes and kills him.
What?
And I wonder if...
Why is it a fist?
Yeah.
If it just explodes, isn't that just a missile?
Maybe. But I wonder if perhaps Adam Jensen's problems would all be solved and people would think that the mechanical men were cooler if they were able to launch rocket fists.
Remote-guided rocket fists.
Or as the Japanese narrator calls them, Rocketsu Fistu. as he declares in loud, gregarious language.
There you go. Well, I hope JGB and the rest of Ubisoft... I just Montreal are listening, because there's still some development time left. Get those robots.
Get that in there. That's what Adam Jensen needs.
They didn't ask for fist.
Very good.
They've been making a big deal of how, we realised last time we overemphasised stealth and really, like, action should have been a more viable option. So this time we're making sure you're not punished for doing action and you're not encouraged to do stealth. It's like, I don't know if that was really how it panned out. I thought actually Human Revolution's one of its very few flaws was that it was too kind on action, too viable.
Mm.
So I'm a little bit worried about that.
I love Human Revolution, and I like how faithful they were to their original game, even though I didn't play or particularly enjoy the original game and the parts that I did play. But it is like looking at Arkham City, and looking at Metal Gear Solid and looking at the things they do with the stealth genre and how kind of fun and action-y they are, even at the same time as being stealthy, just, it does make Deus Ex look just a little bit dry.
Which Deus Ex, the original or Human Revolution?
Human Revolution and now Mankind Divided. It's just that, this doesn't have a horse that I can hide on the side of.
I think saying Deus Ex would be better with a horse.
Why can't I tie anyone to a balloon and launch them into space?
You want a remote control rocket fist, a balloon that you can tie to guards, and a horse you can hide the side of.
Maybe. A stealth game.
I think the thing is, like,
both...
I didn't ask for fists, I asked for a horse!
Rocket horse! A lot of the reason Batman works is because, and the reason the games are so good, is, and the reason they're so inventive for stealth games, is a really rare example of a stealth game where the enemy knowing you're there works to your advantage. Which is, really core to Batman fantasy, right? Which is like, the, you know, the only thing scarier than not having just been beaten up by Batman is knowing that Batman's there. And the way the guards visibly like, oh shit, he's in the room, right? And they go looking for you, but they're terrified. And you can see their heartbeat on the detective thing. That's a huge success for the fiction. And it's also a huge success for stealth genre in general, because it's like, this is how you make it fun. Like, because it means that...
Turns you into the hunter rather than
the hunted. That if you've been slightly detected, it's all part of the plan. Even if it wasn't part of the plan, it's like, you know, it kind of folds into the fantasy in a way that, like, that guy saw me beat that guy up and then vanish into the ceiling.
Yeah, but you don't always want... I know games are actually... I think Conviction did this as well. It was the first Splinter Cell game to make like a seamless transition between stealth and combat, and to make it viable for you to switch between the two. And that's very gratifying as a player, but actually I don't know if that serves the fantasy of being stealthy. Like, I think I actually want to be punished sometimes for failure, whereas games seem to be just like, it doesn't matter, you go and play with your guns.
I think what I want is the balance. Like, I want to be able to choose the approach. Like, I think the gratification of a stealth, like, by its nature, the gratification of a ghost playthrough has to lie entirely with the player. Because the guards don't fucking know. That's the point.
Yeah.
Right? Like, you don't get any other feedback from a ghost playthrough. Because literally, if you did, you fucked it.
Yeah.
I think Batman's great contribution is sort of, making valid this middle path of stealth, where you are being stealthy, but the people know you're there, and they know you're killing them, or... Non-killing them. Non-lethally killing every last fucking one of them. And they're terrified by that. And in every other stealth game, that's frowned upon. It's like, if you're silently killing people, but they see the bodies, that's a flawed stealth playthrough. You fucked it up slightly, and you haven't fucked it up totally, so you're doing okay, but it's an imperfect thing. Whereas Batman is the one game that says, actually, that's part of your plan. You want them to find the bodies. But I don't like that as the only way to... I want to also have the option to completely stealth kill everyone. But actually, Batman, like, for being... Despite being a stealth game, you can't move the bodies ever. And so even after four iterations of this game, you still can't pick up a body and hide it. So when you take someone out, it's just pure chance whether they find it or not.
It's the difference between ghosting and just simply a non-lethal playthrough. And Batman is not about ghosting, because Batman is a symbol and wants everyone to be afraid of him. So
about batting.
You need to be an icon. You need to be seen and known to exist.
It must be iconic.
You know, Batman's iconic Batman.
Yes. You couldn't simply ghost through those levels and everyone be like, who beat up all those people? Who did it?
Who non-lethally pacified all those people?
Yeah. Batman logo in the sky. Well, we don't know that.
Why is this metal bat embedded in this man's head? Not literally.
Very big on branding is Batman.
He is. It's huge.
It's his brand is strong.
Yeah, it's
hashtag
huge
Batman. Branding.
Yeah. Like,
he would have a Twitter account if it was modern day.
Yeah. I mean, but like, if you could hide the bodies, I'd love to hear the reactive dialogue they'd have to record for that, because they do have that kind of like, somebody's been taken out, kind of like in the Russian, they're all frightened now. But like, where the fuck is Dave? Dave! And then there are all the guys spending the rest of the levels walking around yelling this one guy's name that you've scurried away into a vent somewhere.
Meanwhile, Batman's in a cupboard taking selfies with unconscious Dave.
Batman.
Bantman, all right.
Yeah, Bantman. Richard writes, hi, gents. In any role-playing game I can think of, my character is the most uninformed guy or girl in the land. I'm unstoppable in battle, I'm influential in local politics, I own pretty much all the gold coins and rusty daggers in the realm, but every other bugger I come across has news of some major current event that I'm completely unaware of. Didn't I just clear the mountain pass of bandits? I'm definitely the first new face in this village in months, so how come everyone here knows more about Wizard Greyball's curse on the king than I do? I was looking forward to telling you all about it, or perhaps not mentioning it at all.
Preventing the player from having any agency over the flow of information robs us of a fuller sense of empowerment over the future state of the game world. Yes, we will probably be given thumbs-up/thumbs-down control over several decisions along the journey, but those decisions will have been painted into the game world well before we turned up on the scene. The flow of information around the land is always extrinsic to the path of the party, and somehow it always travels faster than the speed of the party. I find this frustrating. I don't want to be the dumbest guy in the land. I want to be able to dick over a village by forgetting to tell them about the impending swarm of locusts. I want to feel that when I'm in and exaggerating about my quest, that is the only knowledge anyone will have about it, and that their behaviour will be influenced by that. Do you agree that the player's lack of agency over information flow is a deficiency of the genre, or do you think it is justified or unavoidable because of the need to advance a predefined plot in a particular order? Can you point me towards a game or a genre where the player has real control over what NPCs know about the world that affects the world in a meaningful way? Essay over. Thanks for continuing to produce a great podcast and congrats on reaching the big C. Cheers, Richard.
That's a good point. I was complaining earlier about how in Mass Effect 2, as Shepard, if you talk to the AI, you act like you don't know anything about your own ship. And it is a newly built ship, but even so, it's kind of spoiled the fantasy for me of being the person who's in charge and who knows everything. And yeah, I can't think of a game where you get to... There are games where you can lie to people and trick them. And like, you can do quests and you can... There are quite a few games where you can pretend to have done a quest. Like, they give you a quest to do, and then you can come back and just say, yeah, I did that, and then you don't have any way of finding that out. But that flow of information is really interesting. There's I think it's like a sort of intellectual, like, theoretical problem, but also reflective of a real problem, where if you have two armies and you're about to attack a city... Like, you're a general and there's another general, and both of your armies have to attack the city at the same time. And it doesn't matter when you do it exactly, but you need to make sure you're both ready to go at the same time. In the days when you didn't have any kind of electronical communication, you'd have to send a messenger to the other person to find it, to tell them, we're going to attack at dawn. And then you need a messenger back from them to say, yes, okay, we're ready to attack at dawn. And I can't remember what it's called. It might be called, like, the two messenger problem or something like that, but it's basically impossible because any of your messengers might be intercepted. And so if you want to send them a message, you need to know whether they got it or not. Because if you say, let's attack at 6 a.m, you don't want to attack at 6 a.m unless you know they got your message to attack at 6 a.m. And the only way you know that is if they send a messenger back. But what if their messenger doesn't get to you? And if there's like a 5% chance that any given messenger won't make it, there is no way for the two generals to ever know for sure that they're both going to attack at the same time. Hmm. And so this incredibly simple problem of, we just need to attack at the same time. Doesn't matter what time it is, we just need to do it at the same time. Can't be solved if you have any imperfection in your communication method.
There are some war games that I have not played, but which Tim Stone has written about.
That's most of them, mate.
Which simulate this for a strategy game. The historical strategy games in which you deliver orders to your troops via messenger, and therefore there is a chance of those orders getting lost, being misinterpreted, or the results of those orders being miscommunicated back to you. And that adds a really interesting level to most strategy games. You know, there's a simplicity even in historical strategy games where they are sometimes just left click command, right click conquer. And adding supply routes and stuff like that can sort of temper that and give you some greater sense of the tactics or the complications of actual battle. But really, the flow of information is a much greater problem that affected most wars up until the age of, say, satellites, which we're living in now. You know, and so really up until 10 to 20 years ago, all wars were just about the flow of information.
Mm.
And almost no game reflects that in any meaningful way whatsoever. But there are a few niche war games that Tim Stone's written about, and I'll try and dig them out so we can link them in the show notes, that do that. especially around like Gettysburg and stuff like that, because that's a really interesting thing.
It's interesting that you couldn't do the Battle of Hastings in a video game without having an AI script that completely fucks over the defenders in that scenario when the cavalry just charge and keep charging and get cut off, because otherwise, you know, if you can click them, it can come back. It doesn't.
Yeah, it would be a very unsatisfying Total War experience.
What the fuck?
I guess, like, Fog of War is on some level an attempt to systematize the discovery of information, but it's not very.
It's not the same
as not the way that information is actually delivered in real life. Like, you don't send your entire army over the hill to see what's on the other side.
Well, Total War should be played more like Frozen Synapse, where you set out a whole plan and then you desperately try and stop it going wrong with lots of kind of possible
things. It should be like Frozen Synapse for the planning phase, but then the actual battle phase is Skyrim, and you're one man, and it registers your microphone, and you just bellow like, "No!" I was going to say, to bring it back to RPGs, this is my experience as a GM, like, is that information is the one thing you have that you can use to make sure the players have a good time. And it's sort of the flip side to it, in a way, is that, like, you want to give the player the most freedom they can possibly have to kind of dictate the story in their own way in terms of where they go and what questions they ask and what they discover and so on. But by holding all of the keys to the information, by always being the person giving the information, this applies to traditional RPG computer design as well, that's where you exert power.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's in what factoids you give and what that maybe implies the players should do and so on. That's why it's such a hard thing to give up, because if you remove that, then the role of the game designer in an RPG scenario is to act purely as the facilitator for a completely dynamic system where, you know, the news of bandit raids down the road is for players to discover through normal means and then impart through normal means with consequences to follow on from that, which can be deeply narratively unsatisfying for both the player and the designer, really, because you might find that everything that happens is really mundane from that point. And that, you know, things that might be really important to the plot get missed. Like, you know, the oldest trick in a GMing book is if the players are maybe missing something that could be really rewarding for them or something, is to have some random fucking villager know slightly more than they should about something. Because it gets, you know what I mean? It's like, well, you've been doing this, but here's something that you should know. Or like, don't be too forced about it. Like, it's a tool that the GM has. Taking that away completely, I'm not saying you shouldn't, like, I actually really love the idea of an RPG that respects the flow of information.
Yeah, it's hard to do that though, because I mean, innately, any kind of game is the flow of information is only ever going to go from the game to the player, because within that information is encased all the kind of possible verbs that can occur in the game. And as soon as you start, it would be impossible to have the player just off their own back just have the freedom to impart any kind of information, because that would suddenly require the game to have an infinite number of verbs and interactions, and you can't predict the kind of information that the player would like to impart, whereas you can control that much more in the other direction.
It was quite interesting when Sleep is Death came out, Jason Rohrer's game, where it's a little bit like DMing. One player kind of sets up the game ahead of time, and then another player plays it. But the person who sets up the game is also actively GMing while it's going on. So if the player does something they didn't account for, like a player, like, you know, if they made a room and you can go north or east, and then the player says, I break down the wall and I go west, then the GM has some time to, like, make a room that goes to the west. One of my favorite, I really loved watching playthroughs of that, because it was just so fascinating to see how the player and the GM would respond to each other. And one of my favorites was, I think, a game made by Bobsy, played by Roberki, who are both friends of mine. And it was like, you were infiltrating a castle and you had to rescue someone, and Roberki figured out that as playing it, like, if you just broke into the castle, he was a thief. But rather than be stealthy, he just said, like, he would just yell, help, help, I need some help, someone's attacking me. And the guards would rush from wherever they were currently guarding up ladders or whatever, and he would just stand to the other side of the ladder, and as soon as they came up, just blackjack them. And then whoever, like, if there are any other guards left, he'd just yell again and then wait for them to come up and blackjack them as well. And it kind of, like, it was a complete exploit, but you could kind of tell that Bobsy, whoever was running it, was
kind of bound by the logic of their own situation. It's like, well, the guards would come, and they would go up a ladder, and they would be facing the direction that they're going to head, and so you would be able to blackjack on the back of this. And again, it's just flow of information. If you, like, if you let the player lie, that turns out to be a super powerful thing.
Yeah, I think I played through I played a bunch of Sleeper's Death, and I think I played through one session that was designed by Robarky, and it was set in like a dystopic future in which my apartment was like a 6-foot by 6-foot room that I think perhaps I shared with another person. And through the course of the story, I, through some event, managed to smash one of the walls open and discover a much larger room with a window that was adjacent to it and connected to it that no one else knew about. And like, in this future in which real estate was at such a premium, this was a tremendous discovery that was like life-changing to have like a room with a window that was like 15 feet by 15 feet rather than 6 foot by 6 foot that you have to share with another person. And then my housemate came home and I had to deal with the situation of like, you know, do I share this with them? Do I try to kill them? Do I, you know, that kind of thing?
Next logical step, kill your husband.
Well, naturally, I tried to kill them. But it was the fact that this was a GM'd experience without the kind of combat rules of D&D or anything made that a super awkward experience of like, almost near neo-scavenger-ish of like grubbly trying to shove this person out of a window when shoving someone out of a window when they're alive and healthy and you're not particularly strong, it's just a really awkward experience.
Well, this is awkward. I'm sorry about this. It'll be over soon, but...
The other thing I did was... might have been with Jason Rohrer himself, actually, because I played it with him once or twice. It was... because there was this element of improv with the GM in which you were partly trying to work with them and partly trying to work against them, and I think they accidentally created a duplicate of me in the environment, or a duplicate of one of the characters in the environment. And so I just had to improvise this moment of pulling out a cardboard cutout of a character and throwing it as a distraction during like an assault on a criminal to like distract them, to make them think that it was like an actual person.
This is a long shot, but...
I really loved that feeling of basically... there has been a fuck up. We both know it is a fuck up. But let's just try to roll with it and make it not just a part of the story, but a part of the game.
Yeah, usually it's a GM who has to roll with the player fuck ups, but it's an interesting idea for the player to have to roll with a GM fuck up. I've accidentally made this room look totally wrong. Can you in some way make this your choice?
I think as the GM you had, what, like 90 seconds to respond to the 30 second move that the player had?
I really wish Sleeper's Death had been like a mega hit. Like, if I could pick one game to have like Minecraft level success, Minecraft well deserved it, but if I had to pick another one, Sleeper's Death, it would be so good just to see what millions of people did with that.
It did, the fact that you could output each step as an individual image and easily fold it into a comic.
That was the beautiful thing.
That was like, a lot of those stories were just really entertaining comics to read.
That was my experience. I never really played it. Comics. I didn't really ever play it. I just watched other people's playthroughs, and that was in itself was massively entertaining. It was just...
yeah, and seeing multiple playthroughs of the same, like, Roborky's design thing, as well as playing through that experience, I think I read like 3 others or something like that. That was really fascinating.
Going back to the original kind of scenario that the questioner suggests, I think there's a huge problem with the conflict between the game's need to educate you and the power which it gives you over the world. Like, you can't manipulate a world that you don't know anything about, and games have a surprisingly limited number of ways in which to impart detailed information to you about a social situation or about the way that these peasants work and the power. Where you are in the hierarchy of this social structure, like, without just people just fucking telling you that stuff, there's very little, there are a few ways for you to learn that in most RPGs. So to just start you in a situation where you can then just manipulate that, it has to educate you first. But the mechanisms by which it educates you are the same mechanisms by which you would have to manipulate them, by your conversations. So the conversations have to be expositional, but then also allow you to manipulate them, which is basically impossible because they're educating you about it, and then you're suddenly assuming a position of power, and then, like, I don't know, that fundamentally doesn't work. Like, if you walk into a village that you don't know anything about because you're a player and you've never been to that village, even if your character, your avatar, knows about it, you can't honestly manipulate it without the village telling you everything about itself.
Yeah.
And that's just fundamentally not going to work.
The thing I'm most interested in isn't the implementation of these features, it's the implementation of these features to such a uniform degree the games no longer feel the need to explain them. Mm. Not because they don't need explaining, but because of the fact that they are no longer labor intensive enough to create, that they need to be a thing that you value after you've bought the game. Like the thing you mentioned earlier about Mario levels, where you could break out of that level and find a secret, and that was a really interesting experience.
Mm. Yeah.
They had no reason to expect, when they made the first Mario game, that Mario was going to be anything like the kind of hit necessary to justify the inclusion of those kinds of secrets. But they did it anyway, because it was, after they built the tools necessary for making Mario levels, relatively trivial to make those kinds of secrets.
Yeah.
And so they didn't need to explain or signal them in any way. And so the interesting thing isn't the implementation of these features in games, it's the implementation of these features in games uniformly such that they don't need to explain that they're there, such that you can just discover them naturally through the course of play. That you can just enter the world and just do stuff. And it is simulated to such a degree that it works the way that you might expect it to.
Yeah, and also you're doing something in a platformer where the entire language is, do I jump here or there? Yeah. Whereas if you're in an RPG with villages and politics and shit, like, that's a whole other kind of numerous dimensions you're introducing.
You jumped on my wife!
Shit!
And so on. Intersectional platforming. Could work, actually.
Richard ends his email by saying, P.S. I'm on a long streak of submitting objectively brilliant questions, but I've all still fallen short of broadcast quality, and I'm wondering if this is actually because I refuse to contribute to the festering cockspell of creating crowbar puns. And I wanted to respond to this to say, no, if we haven't read out your question before, it's not because of not participating in any kind of pun. But at the same time, it's not necessarily a reflection of the quality of the question. It's just a measure of whether we have anything to say in response to the question. And there are many instances where we are asked a good question, but we can't think of an answer.
Yeah.
And in which case, we don't ask it because what would we say?
It would just be awkward.
It would just be quite awkward.
And there's also a thing that goes on where sometimes, like, in the early days of, like, the first 20 podcasts, we were asked a question, like, twice. And for us five, from then on, that question is like, oh, for fuck's sake, this again, really?
We answered that 95 episodes ago!
If you didn't listen to every single one of the podcasts, then you might not have found it so familiar. And so, but it's a deadly cycle, too, because we've answered it before, we don't read it out again. And therefore, no one hears it again. And then anyone who hasn't listened to 100% of our podcasts will think it's a new question and write it in again. So the thing we get very often is like, what two games would you mash up? And I think we've answered that question. It's a good question. We answered it. But it just seems dumb to answer it again and again, like every time someone asks it.
Alexander writes, Dear Creighton Cro-Magnons, have you ever found yourself paralyzed by moral
we just skipped that guy's question.
What? No.
Or is this the continuation?
That was the PS.
Oh, right, okay.
That was
sorry,
the PS, the end of the last question. Alexander says, Dear Creighton Cro-Magnon, have you ever found yourself paralysed by a moral quandary in a game that you are quite certain was not planned by the game writers or designers? This happened to me very recently playing The Witcher 3, when I started to wonder if by wandering around villages, killing a certain class of monsters spawned by the death of terribly mistreated women, wraiths, and really always women, I was in some way complicit in their mistreatment. That I was allowing these societies to escape the cost and memory of how they had failed these women by erasing the very real and deadly consequence of their actions. Viewed that way, the main character, Geralt, becomes some sort of wandering patriarchal enforcer,
which is
really not something I have any interest in being. In the end, I decided that corporal punishment dished out to discorporate entities was a terrible substitute for justice that was unlikely to bring sweeping societal changes, but for a long time I was strongly tempted to stop killing wraiths where, whenever possible. How about yourselves? Best, Alexander.
I really like
that. We have some smart fucking listeners.
yeah. But that particular example is particularly good, because you do go through that world, and all of the ghosts and wraiths and terrible things have been created by the people that they now plague. Yeah. Almost exclusively. And you think, well, they are your kind of just desserts, really. And you're only kind of increasing the justice in the world by raising them.
But sexy human Tippex.
Patriarchal Tippex.
That's
spaffing your Tippex all over the ills of the world, erasing sin with your twin swords and your cool hair.
I think the thing with Geralt is that you basically monetize that.
Yeah. Oh my god, you're the worst person. You enforce the patriarchy, you monetize it, and you Tippex other people's mistakes.
You fucking the people who have made their mistakes, there's a haggling mechanic where you can just take every fucking penny they've got to rob them of the despair that is actually, of their situation.
I mean, like, it's usually optional, but it made me feel so fucking sleazy to help someone who's like whole livelihood being ruined, and then my options are like whether to charge him this much money or that much money.
I really like you mentioned earlier, I think maybe before the pod, that you don't like Geralt, but I really like the relationship of just...
Yeah, I really like him. I play him as a nice man. Maybe you're compelled to play him as a ruthless bastard. I don't know.
I find him sleazy, and I find him just really unpleasant. Though it's true, you do get a lot of choice over that kind of stuff, but there is a preset Geralt personality, and you're pushed into it in various quite subtle ways. I just don't like him. I just don't like him as a person.
In most other RPGs, I find you are the hero or you are the chosen one. And there's something interesting about being the character, which is just, I have no power over the political or military problems that are actually plaguing you. All I can do is kill the supernatural wolf that's killed some of your people. And I only do that for money. And you kind of hate me for it. And like no one ever kind of applauds you and is like, yay, witchers! Everyone's just like, you're scum because you're part mutant. And so you're just this kind of wary traveler who has information about these supernatural creatures that other people don't.
I really like that. I hate being the chosen one. I really, really hate it. And I definitely appreciate not... I mean, you're pretty fucking critical to the fate of the world, but you're not necessarily the saviour of the world. But I can't remember what it was exactly, so I can't really argue my point, but I had a situation where, like, all throughout, I don't want to take any money, I don't want to do anything for cash, but there was a situation where a girl just told someone outright, I won't do this except for money, and I didn't want to do that, and I just felt super sleazy about it.
Haven't encountered that yet.
Maybe I will.
Kind of like the TV show Angel, in which it's a spin-off of Buffy, in which he similarly fights monsters, but he takes money for it because he's got to eat and pay rent and employ staff.
Quite a lot of staff as well. Like, does he have a PA by the end of it?
Probably. Well, I think at the end they work for a law firm.
Cool. I'll play that game.
Yeah. Witcher and Sons.
That'd be awesome.
Wolfram and Hart, I believe the law firm is called. Alexander ends his email by saying that he's not criticizing The Witcher for its depiction of women. He actually thinks it's doing much better than the previous games. Which I kind of agree.
Yeah, definitely doing better. But
they're climbing a ladder from literal booby trading cards.
I just mentioned that there is some gratuitous nudity, but in general, its female characters have more agency and more.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. That's what I was saying.
Yeah,
it's true. I think The Witcher 2 wasn't bad as well. Like, it was.
It was a big step forward.
The Witcher 1 I really disliked. I really found it properly creepy and unpleasant. Witcher 2, I had issues with the game, but they weren't generally to do with massive rampant sexism, and which I think is better still. I think they've got better with each one.
Yeah, it's worth celebrating the fact that a company seems to have listened to feedback and filtered parts of it which are reasonable and responded to
They still have been criticised for it, and it's kind of like the thing they've arrived at with number 3 is kind of the Game of Thrones situation where the person writing it is not a massive sexist, but they're writing a massive sexist world. And so there are some who think that by writing a massive sexist world, they're kind of being a massive sexist, and there are some who think by writing a massive sexist world, they're using that as a context to complain about sexism.
Mm.
And yeah, definitely the latter is true to an extent, but whether the former is true is kind of... I see the point.
There's an element of having your booby cake and eating
it. Yes. Oh, God! I wasn't going to phrase it that way, but that's...
It was like, well, this is a sexist world, but don't we all like tits? There's a little bit of that about both Game of Thrones.
Yes. Oh, isn't this terrible? This lady has to get her breasts out on screen for many.
Yeah, this is the assumption that, like, you're depicting a sexist world in order to expose the sexism within it for men. It's like the kind of the end hypocrisy of these things. It's like, hey guys, isn't this sexist? Which is, you've sort of fucked it at that point. Again, you fucked the
pudding.
Hello, excuse me, man. Isn't this sexist?
Sometimes in Game of Thrones, it's, oh, isn't prostitution terrible? Better put an exposition scene in front of that point. Have that point be made in the background, where we describe some things that are slightly boring. Yeah, I don't know. Eloise writes, "Dear Crayfish and Crawdads, in the last podcast you discussed the problem of adequately representing disempowerment in games. If the definition of a game is a collection of systems at which the player becomes increasingly adept and therefore powerful, you discussed a couple of possibilities and dismissed both of them, but with a few small alterations, both of your suggestions could use game mechanics to incorporate an increasing feeling of disempowerment. It just depends on what definition of disempowerment you use. Number one, disempowerment is increasing powerlessness in the world. As Tom was describing, you start out with all the gadgets and as the game progresses, they are locked off. Only difference is, it turns out, you really needed those gadgets to succeed. Imagine Batman gradually losing the Batmobile and the cape. Everyone would love him to lose the Batmobile.
Yeah.
Gradually losing the Batmobile and the cape and the grappling hook and eventually becoming just a self-pitying man in form-fitting underwear, frantically trying to fend off crooks. I mean, it's a Frank Miller comic, isn't it? Number two,
Grant Morrison.
Disempowerment as structural prejudice. And I think this is the far more interesting hypothetical game. If, for example, you kept in the Dragon Age universe's persecution of elves/mages, it allowed players to play as those classes, but explicitly framed doing so as the game's hard mode. Not only would you incentivize empathy by constructing minority status as more challenging, with a nod to this excellent post, and then she links to Scalzi's post about how straight white male is the lowest difficulty setting in life, which we will link in the show notes. But you could use common game systems to easily create a feeling of marginalization. E.g., prices are higher, some lodgings could be unavailable to you, making it harder to find a rest point. Food could be lower quality, replenishing less health. Guards would be more likely to become aggressive. It's harder to recruit group members of certain classes, etc., etc. You could even use game zones to this end. Your starting area is progressive and mostly accepting, but the final zone still keeps slaves of your race, putting you in an uncomfortable position where your increasing power as a player highlights the stark difference between you and those who are still enslaved. I'd also love to see the indie/choose-your-own-adventure incarnation of this, where you are trying to negotiate the world as a minority with a self-esteem bar that you need to maintain. You would have to decide between compromise, which makes passage through the world easier but lowers your self-esteem, or authenticity, which makes individual interactions trickier but doesn't damage your sense of self. I suppose the question here is, do you think that gamifying the extra difficulties experienced by marginalized groups is the right way to depict their experiences in games? Thanks for a great podcast. Eloise.
Quickly. I'd say, I don't think I missed the original question when it was first asked, but Papers, Please is a brilliant disempowerment arc.
Yeah, actually, that was a good example. Yeah.
Oh, did you bring
that? No, we didn't, but I thought of it in the interim, and I was like, oh, I should have mentioned that.
Is that so you're actually given more and more abilities, but actually that oppresses your ability, that oppresses you more and more as you go through the game.
For better performance, you get more money, and that empowers you more to.
Yeah, but it doesn't let you.
If you're really good at the stamping game, you get to keep your family in perfect health and just coast through. Not coast through, but it's still difficult. But it's much easier if you're good at the skill-based game.
And yet, you're still compromising something. I think that's the thing that it does: is it locks you into a gamey system of empowerment, which is actually some way contrary to your instinct.
Yeah, there's.
You do have to rely on people.
That's the thing. Is that
your success at your job is not the only metric of success.
And there's
one that's directly opposite to that, and then separate to those two, there's kind of like just what do you want to do as a person? Are you okay with this, and are you okay with that?
Well, even actually, as you mentioned, I think after we finished recording last podcast, The Witcher is a perfect example of this for the same reasons that you are.
Yeah, we just talked about there are instances in The Witcher in which you encounter people with problems that you're just not equipped to solve because their problems stem from the fact that they are the population of a country which has just been invaded by an army which is now an invading force and which is now creating situations in which they are starving and through their starvation or their desperation forced to commit crimes. And you come along and you're really only equipped for fighting big bad monsters. You're not really politically adept or relevant. And any time in which you try to interact with the simpler economic problems of the society, you just sort of make things worse. And I don't think this is a huge spoiler and I can keep it vague, but, you know, there are situations in which people commit crimes out of economic desperation caused by the fact that they've been invaded, and your interaction with that causes that person to be hanged. And it's like, well, that was a criminal that you just led to being hanged, but the person was only a criminal for the fact that they were desperately trying to get enough food together to feed themselves and their family. So it doesn't really feel heroic. It feels like you are irrelevant in the vast array of ways in which these people live their lives. You know, if they've got a monster or a ghost or a wraith or whatever to kill, then you'll do it as long as they give you enough money to buy food for yourself. And that's a kind of disempowerment. Mm. The other example I thought of, but haven't played, but I think you have, Marsh, is Carp Life.
Yeah.
Mm, FA Carp
Life. Yeah, but I actually don't particularly like that as a game. For the exact same reason that I think Eloise's example of Batman is somewhat flawed, because yes, you can essentially just take things away from the player and make their options fewer and fewer, but that's actually actually not just a sense of disempowerment, but that's also a sense of lacking interaction. Like, you're just reducing the game space. Mm. You're kind of making it less of a game by doing so. I think Cart Life is not quite like that, but it's on that trajectory where you are disempowered to the point where you are just struggling to be able to master a system and everything's set against you. And once you realise that's the case, you kind of understand that parable instantaneously. You're like, oh, this is a game system, I can't really win properly. Why? Well, I know that now. Why would I bother to carry on playing it? And I think the more persuasive ways in which games can tell you about disempowerment are where you have a system of empowerment, but it is actually kind of adverse to your interests in some way. I don't know.
I was going
to
add that there's... actually, you know, the analogy about, you know, privilege amounting to easy mode is actually a really good one.
Yeah, yeah.
But you extend that analogy too far the other way and it breaks down. And so the example given about, you know, opting into hard mode by playing as a minority character in Dragon Age, say we're elf or a mage, while that might be the flip side to a good analogy, in that, you know, privilege amounts to easy mode, I don't think the reverse is actually true, for the reason that what hard mode connotates in games is a willingness on the part of the player to master the game at its most difficult setting, and that is absolutely not what social disempowerment is. Nobody who is disempowered socially
has mastered being a minority. I'm the best at it.
I am so fucking good at this.
No one has opted in mastering social systems at their toughest level. Like, no one has chosen that. That is not the reality of being disempowered. It's not that it's a good idea for imparting those. It's not that it's not a good idea for imparting those ideas to the player in some ways. But as soon as it's framed as, for example, hard mode,
it carries this bunch of extra gaming connotations that just really aren't appropriate to that kind of exchange socially. A far better way of, and it's all because of the nature of choice. It's all about who you choose to be, right? The whole concept of privilege, disempowerment, or whatever, doesn't mean anything if you give people choice over who they are born as. Like, at that point, yeah, it's a difficulty setting. And it becomes almost as trivial as that. Because you chose. Whereas people don't have choices about that. They don't choose who they are. And so you need to frame it in that way in order to make a game about it. You need to play the game where it works more like Rust.
Yeah, where Rust you're, is a really great example.
Where
I really,
your I love being that is tied
Gary
to your social.
Is doing this. So the Rust system is that your Steam ID is tied to a skin colour, a particular character, basically, and everything about your character is determined by Steam ID, including now your penis length.
Yeah.
They are, I think right now you can only be male, but they are adding female characters too. Yeah, and everything about you is just, whether it's, you know, big or small, or positive or negative, or whatever, like, things you want to assign to your attributes, it's all just kind of randomly generated, but it's tied to your Steam ID, so you can't change it. Restarting the game doesn't help. You will always be this person, and if it's decided you are a black guy with blue balls, bright pink hair, you're just that forever.
It sort of feels like that's a greater act of increasing empathy in human beings than Cart Life or Papers, Please.
Which is so exciting, because Gary Newman is basically an asshole. I really like him. I really respect him, and he's great. But he doesn't give a fucking shit about what you think about his game. And if you think his game is terribly violated in some way, he will just laugh at you publicly. And he delights in banning people in his forums. I've always been fascinated by him because he's been massively successful, but he's never once kind of kowtowed to his community. He's always been like, if you don't do what I fucking like, you are banned forever and you can never play my game. And even if you paid for it, fuck off. You can't ever have it. And he's also, I mean, like, his community are also incredibly, the fringe of his community are horrible. Like, he runs a thing called Gary's Mod, which is a Half-Life 2 mod that lets you mess around with the physics and make your own comics and scenarios and cool things. It's basically a very creative thing. Sandbox. But every time he updates it, he kind of breaks everything everyone's ever made. Because it's like, well, now the logic by which you can make things is different, and it's better. We've made the game better. But that means that the most hardcore players are now furious because I made this particular thing and now it doesn't work the way I thought it does. And so he just gets regular death threats. Just every fucking day of his life, he gets someone saying, I'm going to kill you in your sleep unless you revert the latest patch. And yet it's also been incredibly successful. He's, you know, it's just sold better and better every year for his entire life. And now he's a multi-millionaire. But yeah, it's forged this weird... Maybe he would always have been this person no matter what, but certainly the person he's ended up as is someone who kind of ignores feedback and just says, fuck you, I'm doing this, this is the right thing to do, so fuck off. And it's so great that that person has ended up being a person who's just saying, fuck you, you're black now.
He was, like, from very early on, was just super hardcore about banning people on his forum. Like, that almost was why we heard of him more than Gary's Mod was, like, back when Gary's Mod was just a mod rather than a thing you could sell individually on Steam. I knew of Gary as a person who took a particular hard line on his own forums. But it's interesting because the line that he takes on his forums is sort of the line we take at Rock Paper Shotgun, where we're trying to build a kind of liberal, progressive sort of safe space. Is like, no, it just means you have to ban a lot of people. Yeah. It just means you gotta have zero tolerance and no freedom of speech. It was sort of interesting the ways in which you align with people because from the outside you would think that you would not be aligned with them.
He's always just been like, not only does he ban those people and single them out, he will, like, publicly single them out. He will make a big deal of it. But, like, I just banned this guy for saying this fucking stupid thing. And not certainly not everyone he bans, and certainly not everyone his moderators bans, because that's thousands of people a day, I think. But he will really kind of rub it in. And so, yeah, it's great that he's taking up that cause.
Michael Cook writes via the Twitter holds.
I know that guy.
Mm-hmm. If you could go back and record an episode on some week in games history before episode 1 aired, when would it be?
And then he asks a follow-up question that says, and why is it the week that Deus Ex was released?
Yes, that is the follow-up question that he asks.
Which, I mean, yeah, probably. The trouble is we don't have... So have you seen there's an image going around recently about, like, okay, it's 1985 and the weekend is this date, what do you go and see? And it's like... just a list of 5 of the most respected films in history all came out that weekend.
Back to the Future?
Yeah. I think The Goonies and a bunch of others. But the trouble is, like, with games, like, we might remember, we're impressive games journalists if we remember what fucking year a thing came in. We don't remember what week it came out in. Yeah. I have no idea what week Deus Ex came out in. Like, no matter how obsessed I am with the game, I don't know what week it came out in.
I guess there was, like...
I don't know what week Gunpoint came out in. I made that game.
I guess, for me, it would probably be the week that Half-Life 2 came out in, which I think was November 2003. I don't think there was anything particularly else notable that came out that single week.
Mm.
But Half-Life 2 was probably the game I was most excited about
in
my life. And probably the game I will ever be most excited about.
That's probably the only thing.
I'm much older
in my life I'll be that excited about.
Yeah, like,
if I have a child, I'll be probably more excited about.
It's like Harold Life 2.
Half-Life 1 came out in 1988, and Half-Life 2 came out in 2003, I think.
I will call my child that, just
Harold Life 2.
And I don't... I'm older now, I don't think I'm capable of such
I think back to Half-Life 2's launch and I think I want to be that excited again, but maybe it wasn't so much about the game, maybe it was more about the point I was in my life, and maybe I'm just too cynical now to ever be that excited about anything
like,
ever again.
As the baby of this group, like, I was, I think, too young for that to be the week that I would choose. Like, I was still really excited. Like, I got my Steam account for the launch of Half-Life 2, but I was 12.
Holy shit.
Which, like...
I was working at PC Gamer, and me and Craig, like, came in at 7 a.m. and had special Half-Life 2 Day hats that we made. We were like, woo!
I think I was, like, 18, and so I worked at PC Gamer for the release of Episode 1, but not for Half-Life 2.
Maybe I was, like, 13, 14, actually. What year was it?
I think 2003.
It's weird that I don't know this.
I
know Half-Life 1 date, I know Deus Ex date. I don't know Half-Life 2 date. What?
Half-Life, I'm pretty
sure. Was 2004?
Are you sure it was 2003? I thought it was earlier than that.
I think it certainly wasn't earlier than that. I'm pretty sure, like, Half-Life 1 was November 98. Half-Life 2 was November 2003. Vampire Bloodlines was September 2003.
That wasn't the same month
as and then 2005, I think, was episode 1.
No, so it completely ignored me. I was 16. But the kind of point stands, I guess.
It could have possibly been 2004 for Half-Life 2.
I'm Googling it right now, so we're going to find out very shortly.
You could still want to be there for the launch. I was going to pick a week, I'd pick the week that...
It was 2004, November 16th.
I'd pick the week that the original Doom launched, because I can only imagine that was like, you know, if we had our heads about our... us now, we weren't, you know, it was to be a very high pitched podcast if we were recording at the age when we did it.
I was
83,
I think.
1933,
yeah.
Yeah.
What? I was 8 years old.
I was 6.
A few months after Mist, we were debating, you know, which is the better first person game.
Really good. My memories of Doom were, I think we had like a 286 when it came out, and then a while after it came out, we got a 486, and the thing I remember about it was, that difference, getting, like, it was the same, we could already run it on a 286, but on a 486 we could run it smoothly, like 30 FPS full screen, and I'd never seen that ever before, anything. Like, I think we'd had Wolfenstein before, but we had to run that in like a half size window. Remember in the old days, you couldn't reduce the resolution, you just shrink the window, so you would just, it had a big border around everything. And then Doom was like 10 times better looking, and then also upgrading the PC meant that it ran, proper smooth frame rates. And I remember talking to my high school friends the next day about what Doom was like on a 486, and my impression of that was so, like,
like ecstatic. It was a picture of Matt, of a man in religious ecstasy. Could not control his body or his thoughts or anything. I was just in pure rapture.
I don't think I had any experience of Doom till I was an adult. I think we rented Wolfenstein for the SNES when I was a kid. They gave me nightmares.
It was on the SNES. I didn't even know that.
Yeah, it was ported to everything. And then my next experience of id was Quake in like 95 or something like that. I don't think I knew that Doom existed.
You didn't know Doom until skipped Doom.
Yeah, skipped Doom until I was.
I think I skipped from Wolfenstein to Quake as well. Actually,
that's amazing.
Weirdly,
yeah, I remember we had. We had some lodgers staying with us at the time. For some like complex corporate reasons, my dad's company had some Dutch lodgers staying with them, and they were also into video games. And they were the only people I knew out of all my friends and myself who were playing Doom without the cheats. If you knew the cheats, you were typing in the fucking cheats. You were invulnerable all the time. You had all the weapons. Of course, if you could have the BFG, why would you not have the BFG? If you could be invulnerable to enemy bullets, why would you not be invulnerable? I didn't understand why you would ever want to be hurt by enemies. I don't want to be. Like, I can turn that off. Of course I'll turn it off. Of course, if I can have all the weapons and all the keys and all the infinite ammo, I'll do that. And I'll just kill everybody. And I remember, like, my Dutch lodger was like, no, you should play without the cheats because it will be ultimately rewarding. I was like, what the fuck are you talking about?
Mysterious.
Shut up, man.
I kind of...
go back to Holland.
I remember being amazingly excited about the Orange Box. And I think actually being on the internet properly actually added... I hate the internet in all its forms. When it comes to actually being excited about stuff, it's fucking amazing. And the buzz around the Orange Box, especially when TF2 turned out to just, like, everyone said it was good, but until you actually played it and were online, just having so much fun in that community. And then Portal being this incredibly, and then all the memes that just kind of burst out of that.
Halfway through episode 2, Team Fortress 2 and Portal were all in the same box for like $20 or something. What the fuck was that?
It wasn't just the Orange Box, it was the Orange Box and I think the Black Box, and people were just fucking outraged
for the Guild Wars.
I don't want a fucking Portal! What Portal? I just want Half-Life for the next Half-Life! What the fuck is this fucking thing? I don't play Team Fortress! What the fuck is this? People were just furiously angry about
the black box completely
you have to pay extra money. And the fact that it came with Half-Life 2 for free. I was like, why do I already own Half-Life 2?
Fuck you, Valve!
Nothing has changed.
I can't remember if it was Chet or someone else at Valve joked that, like, if we put $10 in a $5 box, people would yell at us at this point.
Yeah, that was Chet. But I think it was $50 in a $20 box. But yeah,
The Orange Box and other like big releases have been made more special by having that online community to celebrate it with. And with Portal being this sort of like unexpected explosion of memes, especially and
just memes at go-go,
just fucking memes all over the shop, everywhere, going in your brain and
dank memes.
It was, and it was like episode 2 was the low point of that thing. In hindsight, like the excitement around the thing was such a social experience that this amazingly well-made single-player element of it—it's
the best Half-Life has ever been, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's
absolutely love it. Yeah. It's the best.
It's amazing, and yet that in my mind is just takes a lower place than.
Joking about this the other day, but like
it's because it's the only one in that box not to have had a sequel.
If you teleported back to 2007 or whatever it was, and told me, "Hey, after this, Valve become primarily a company that just release remakes of old games as free-to-play things." And they never really bothered with Half-Life after this. And you know, what? What are you talking about? What?
It'll happen. We'll all be dead.
Yeah, it will happen eventually. It's going to be a very long time.
And that's all the time we have for questions. If we haven't read your question, it's just because we have nothing to say in response to this. Remember, but if you want to send us questions of your own, you can do so, Chris.
By emailing us at questions@creatingcrowbar.com. Incidentally, my answer to the previous question was going to be the week Mass Effect was released, but never mind, let's skip ahead. Or by tweeting us at Creating Crowbar. Or by leaving a question on our forum at creatingcrowbar.com/ forum, where you should go anyway, because the people there are nice and the episode discussion is intelligent in a way that the latter half of almost all of our episodes aren't.
I like that by the time we get to the latter half, we're like still cogent enough to compliment the intelligent questions, but we're not intelligent enough to actually
respond to them in a meaningful way. Anyone who doesn't have a question answered on this podcast should not feel bad about it.
Slurring some of the words in the in the questions that we did read out.
Yeah, so, exactly. Like, you know, we're not role models.
I don't think I am.
No.
Just Marsh is a role model. The rest of us are not.
No.
It's taken us 100 episodes to figure this out, but Marsh is indeed the best.
Well, no, but it was 100 episodes ago that Marsh said both questions from questions, a phrase that we've never managed to get away from.
Despite it making no sense.
And the other phrase that we'll say very soon, which we've also never been able to get away from. If you would like to follow us on Twitter as individuals, you can do so by following us as individuals on Twitter. That's a tautology, but my Twitter handle is @CThurston.
What is yours, Marsh Davis?
It's Marsh Davis.
How do you spell that?
D-A-V-I-E-S.
Tom Francis.
Mine is Pentadact, which is not good my name. P-E-N-D-A-D-A-C-T.
Where does that name come from, Tom?
It's the start of the Latin name for the South American bullfrog. Leptodactylus. Pentadactylus.
I've known you for quite a long time now, Tom, and I never knew that.
Neither did I, that's so why I suddenly asked it.
I like frogs.
Anyway, I, Tom Senior, am at PCGLudo.LUDO.
And you, Tom Senior, are at...
Andrew.
Wait, mate,
actually. That was Tom Senior before me.
Wow.
I'm at Gonnas, G-O-N-N-A-S, and my Twitter handle comes from Half-Life 1 Deathmatch, where I would type smack talk in for the person I would play one-on-one deathmatch with on 56k modems on servers we would host ourselves. And one time I typed in, gotta kill you, but then I connected to a server which truncated those names down to a single word, and it truncated it down to Gonna. So Gonna was my username for a while. And then when signing up for, and this is true, a username for Napster, Gonna was already taken. So I added an S and I became Gonnas.
Amazing.
As I have been ever since, Origin despite story. The fact that it sounds a bit like Gonna. I am at Gonnas on Twitter.
Hello, and sorry for interrupting. This is Chris, 4 days later, trying to edit the podcast despite the noise we're about to collectively make. To make this listenable at all to anybody, I've lowered the volume for the part that follows by about 8 decibels. It's still terrible. I apologize.
Oh my god, that's...
No one can say we phoned it in.
It's not even
they can, Tom. They really can.
They can, but they'd be wrong.